stacks, strings to stomp boxes. It's Guitar Center's 72-hour Guitar-a-thon kickoff. Epiphone Acoustics, $99. Half-off guitars from Gibson, Ibanez, Yamaha, Gretsch, BC Rich, and more. And for 3 days only, buy any electric guitar at $399 or more, get an amp with reverb free. And get this, DJ's spinoff is back. Grand prize is a 2006 Scion XB, powered by Technique, Nike, Obey, and Stone Throw. Check GuitarCenter.com for details. Guitar-a-thon savings in every department. Drum machines, keyboards, four-track recorders, just $99. Behringer mixers, $39. Buy any Shure mic. Get a stand-in cable free. And get a free Guitar-a-thon poster while supplies last. Guitar Center's Guitar-a-thon kickoff. Savings start Friday. Don't miss it.
Tell them out outside a Radio Shack, and I have breaking news. Confirmed reports say that Singular is now available at Radio Shack. Sources also tell me that Singular has the nation's largest digital voice and data network, and they're the only ones with rollover minutes. Chief, I think I better go inside and talk to one of their knowledgeable sales associates and buy one of their phones for myself. You know, for research. Lamout is out.
Singular Wireless is now at Radio Shack. So don't just get a phone. Get a new Singular phone at Radio Shack.
If you're in debt and considering a loan or bankruptcy, it's time for you to stop and talk to the experts at Trinity First. They'll provide you with a free debt analysis and a proven plan to get you out of debt.
Trinity gave us one monthly payment we could handle.
They reduced our interest, so over time, we saved thousands.
Trinity!
Call the experts at Trinity now for your free debt analysis at 800-741-8205. 800-741-8205.
And now, another Comcast Consumer Update.
This just in. An important announcement on the weather from Heather. Heather.
April showers bring May flowers, but rain anytime can bring rain fade to satellite dish owners. It's an annoying problem, especially during the final 2 minutes of the big game or in the middle of a movie. But those of us with Comcast needn't worry. The Comcast signal is reliable in rain, heavy cloud cover, whatever. And hear the little rhyme to help you remember that. If a reliable signal is your wish, get Comcast and ditch the dish. Hugh?
Catchy. Well, there you have it. Ditch the dish. Call 1-888-COMCAST now and save up to $400 when you order Comcast Digital Cable. That's 1-888-COMCAST.
This has been a Comcast Consumer Update. New customers only. After promotion, standard rates apply. Installation, taxes, franchise fees apply. Savings options vary. Call Comcast for details. Restrictions apply. Limited time offer.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome. We're going to talk about immigration tonight. What else? And I'll talk about why we're only going to talk about immigration. Actually, you can talk about anything you want, and I'll probably bring in some other things as well. But our phone number, 313-298-WRIF. That's good all around the continental United States. Hey, probably good in Hawaii, and it's good all across the world, now that I think of it. We even got a call last week from Finland, a listener, regular listener, Jacob from Oulu, Finland. And get this. So now I got an email from someone else in Finland commenting on what the first Finnish listener said. So the show is international. That's good. Mainly, though, we're broadcasting on WRIF in the southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, northern Ohio area, but we're available on the internet all across the country and all across the world. Email goes to calltalkyes, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I want to, before we talk about immigration, and you can call 313-298-WRIF, but don't call up and say dumb stuff. I'm really in a foul mood about all of this because I've been getting a lot of dumb emails. You know, I'm usually pretty nice. And usually I'll say I don't agree with it or something like that. I try to be a nice guy, but it's dumb. But let me just get to the ground rules here. Justice Antonin Scalia, the most far-right Supreme Court justice who should recuse himself from any number of cases. In other words, he is so prejudicial, he'll hang out with Cheney and then rule on some case involving Cheney. It goes on and on. Plus, I mean, given what he has said about the Constitution, he probably would have, I'm sure he would have voted, what was the vote on it? The Dred Scott vote in, what was it, the 1830s or something like that upheld slavery, probably would have voted to uphold segregation in Plessy versus Ferguson. He probably would have voted against Board of Education. What is it? All of a sudden, I forgot this right out of my brain. Brown versus Board of Education that ended segregation. He probably would have voted against that. So, but there's a pattern here in the way people respond to critics. Now, he's in church, Scalia is, a few days ago, and he was in the Cathedral of the Holy Cross. And you know how devout all these right-wingers are, how they praise the Lord, and they love the Lord, and they always say, God bless America, at the end of everything they say. And most people that are thinking that whenever you hear any politician invoking anything spiritual, you either got to, you know, reach for your wallet or head for the door in other countries, right? And as we've talked a lot in the past, that the intertwining of the state and religion is a deadly combination, deadly to democracy. That's why the Founding Fathers put as the very first item in the Bill of Rights, not guaranteeing us anything, but guaranteeing that there would never be an official establishment of religion. So frightened were they of the intertwining. And Scalia is on the exact opposite end. So he's going to church, this devout man, this believer in Jesus and the Pope and all these other good things about religion. So he's asked by a reporter and freelance photographer, Peter Smith. He says, where is this question here? He asked him, let me see, where is this now? Where's the question? He said, what do you say to your critics who disagree with you about your views about the separation of church and state? I'm talking very slowly here because I'm looking for, oh yeah, here. Smith snapped a photo of Scalia flicking his hand under his chin after a Boston Herald reporter asked the conservative jurist his response to people who question his impartialities on matters of church and state. So he flicked his finger under his chin, and he says, to my critics, I say, favunculo, right? Favunculo. And he said, while making the gesture, and he said, that's Italian for F you. I mean, he says this in the Holy Cross Church. Favunculo. All right, that's what I say to my critic. Well, critics. Now, Cheney told someone, I can't even, someone write or call, too. 313-298-WRIF or calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Cheney told someone F you as well. And one time Bush and Cheney were talking, and they were overheard calling someone an a-hole. So what? You say, well, guys talk like that. But this is the political world. This is where matters of great social concern, of economic importance, of political import are made. And this, again, and this is what I keep trying to make the point over and over again, these conservatives all have this fascistic bent to them because an opponent, someone who questions his impartiality on matters of church and state, it's not, well, here, I disagree with them, and I try to be impartial as possible because it's the justice of the Supreme Court, blah, 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 blah. No, it's favunculo. Well, here's what I'm going to do. Anybody can call up 313-298-WRIF, except if you're a conservative, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, if you have questions, if you have an opinion, and it turns out to be something I disagree with, I'll do what I usually do. I'll say, I disagree with you, and here's why. But if you're a conservative and one of these admirers of Scalia, and you start talking, I'm just going to say, favunculo, and hang up on you. All right? Maybe I won't. You can see about that. All right. Peter Werbe here on the Night Call Show, 313-298-WRIF. Let's talk about immigration. And it's rather distressing in many ways. Well, here's what's not distressing. Because I was getting a lot of email. I thought, how can these people get their chain pulled so easily? I bet these are the same people that are saying, round them all up and ship them back out, and they're stealing our jobs, and the reason that there's cold weather in April, or what are we in? Yeah, we're in April. And April is because of the illegal immigrants. I mean, virtual hysteria. And I got to believe, I suspect these are the same people that got fooled by Bush on every single deal about terror and about the war in Iraq and that these tax cuts that go to the wealthy. I can't wait to get those tax cuts. These are the same people that get fooled over and over and over again. And that's why I said at the beginning of last show I should be playing that old classic rock tune by The Who, Won't Get Fooled Again, except they will. And they'll get fooled over and over and over again. And, you know, I keep repeating this little mantra about Lincoln's dictum about you can fool all the people some of the time. And that's not happening now. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And you can fool some of the people all the time. Well, those are the people that get fooled time after time after time. And you would think that they would figure it out. And they just don't. What was that quote that Bush mangled so badly? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I don't know if you ever heard that, absolute mangled way he repeated that, but it's pretty incredible. But I was heartened by this poll, and this is from the Associated Press. Americans are divided about whether illegal immigrants help or hurt the country, according to a poll. More than one half of those questioned are open to allowing undocumented workers to obtain some temporary legal status so they can stay in the United States. At the same time, people doubt that erecting a fence along the U.S.-Mexican border would help to fix such a complex and enduring problem. Two-thirds do not think it would work. So that's very heartening. Well, it's not going to work, and it's not the solution, and it doesn't even come close to the problem that we are facing, that the middle class is facing, that the working poor in this country are facing. And does it help or hurt the country? Well, there's a little of both. There is a hurt. I mean, when you have an expanded pool of labor and our labor is sold on the open market without union protection, without unions artificially raising the selling price of labor, that's what's going on. We peddle our labor. And if there's a lot of it, like in China or Indonesia or someplace like that, the price is very, very, very low. What we have done in the United States over the last 120 years or so is we've bid up the price of our labor. We've said, hey, as long as the wealth is flowing to the ruling class, and I know some of you when I say this, say, ruling class, don't the commies talk about the ruling class? Let me get to that in a minute. Hold that on a sidebar, all right? This expanded pool of labor. Well, there's not great unemployment in this country. There is more than is reported. There's a lot of people they call discouraged workers, a lot of people working part-time and what have you. And yet, if we were to magically make these evil illegal immigrants, these hated brown-skinned people from south of the border, magically disappear, there'd be a labor shortage. I mean, to some extent, that would pump up the wages. Of course, then people would say, wow, this job I was getting $5.15 an hour for is now paying $9 or $15 an hour. I'm going to come back. But let's go a little deeper into this. Let me see here. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here. This letter from John. These people ought to be deported immediately, and the businesses who hire them for substandard wages ought to be fined severely. If you complain about lousy wages for labor, why would you take a position that exacerbates the problem? Well, I haven't really taken any position because the solutions are so deep, so systemic, so let me just stay with those words like that. Now, one Republican lawmaker, you get an idea of the kind of humanity of these people. See if this rings any bells. He has advocated rounding up all of the illegal immigrants. What do we estimate? There's 8 million, but so let's say 2 million is escape. All right, so we round up 6 million. Let's keep that figure in our brain. We round up 6 million of the illegal immigrants. And I don't know why I lost this piece that had this quote on it, or I'd give you his name. And he wants to take them down to tent cities. Of course, they'd have to have barbed wire around them, right? Or they'd leave. Who's going to be rounded up and put in a tent city unless they're with armed guards and razor wire and what have you? And then be forced. This is the Republicans' idea. Be forced to build this 700-mile wall that would wall us off from our hated southern neighbor. It's kind of scary historic analogy, isn't it? But that's where these people are coming from. Another person. Actually, this is the same guy that made the remark last week that set so many, understandably, set so many of you off, that talked about a lazy UAW janitor. A lazy UAW janitor makes about as much money as I do and gets much better benefits to boot. So I told him, I wrote him back, I said, well, you don't know what you're talking about. So in this, and some of you answered him quite well as well. Typically, UAW workers, this is a new email, and I got to stop this. I mean, this is not a chat room, or what do they call that? It's not a chat room. This is a radio show, and sort of writing people back all the time. It's probably more than I can do too much of, given the volume of mail. Anyways, typically, says Brian, Brian's from Taylor. This is a working-class suburb. This is a working-class suburb, and he sounds like the worst of the bosses. Of the ruling class. Oh, yeah, I was going to tell you about the ruling class. I guess we'll just get... Oh, yeah. Steve King, representative, a Republican from Iowa, says the elite class in America is becoming a ruling class, and they've made enough money to by hiring cheap illegal labor that they think they also have some kind of right to cheap servants to manicure their nails and their lawn. So this ruling class, this new ruling class of America, is expanding a servant class at America at the expense of the middle class of America. And everything he says is true up to there. It's not doing it at the expense of the middle class. The blue collar of America that used to be able to punch a time clock, buy a modest house, and raise their family, those young people are cut out of this process. So somehow the immigrant labor, particularly that is centered in the Southwest, but it has expression all across the country, they're responsible for people, for white collar workers getting laid off at General Motors, for what... What is the name of the company? Boy, you know, every once in a while you get those. I got too much on my brain. Delphi, right? That what Delphi is trying to do to its workers. That's all because of immigrant labor, right? No, I don't think so. It has nothing to do with it. But it's all part of the larger picture. Now, one of the things that our pal John from Taylor says, you know, if you think, why is he not more prepared, is I've got too much stuff here. This stuff is overwhelming my brain. And one of the things that I would suggest to you, I had a long talk with one of the DJs here, and she was saying, man, I can't figure this out. And I was saying, you know, I've got a lot of problems with it too. So if you're making snap decisions, you're making it on the basis of a lack of information. Let me tell you that. All right, here's what Brian from Taylor, he talks about lazy UAW janitor. How many lazy UAW janitors has this guy seen, right? I bet he doesn't even know how many UAW janitors there are. So anyways, he says, typically, UAW workers are mentally lazy. Yes, it's true that many of them do a lot of physical work. Unfortunately, in today's U.S. job market, muscles increasingly are not worth near as much as brains. Now, he just said UAW workers make more than he does, so it kind of disproves that. The UAW may succeed in squeezing as many pennies as it can out of the U.S. auto industries, but their days are numbered. Well, that could be true, but it sure ain't the UAW's fault. He said, I read in the paper today the average Delphi UAW worker earns about $80 an hour, including benefits. So what this guy wants, he wants lower wages. So they're going both ways. Kick out all the immigrants. Kick them all out. Round them up. Put them on cattle cars. Put them into these barbed wire enclosed tent cities and make them build a wall at gunpoint. That's a great little image for our country, isn't it? Just the rounding up of 8 million. So one of the things is, if you and I could come to an agreement that these people are harming the country, these people, right, and they all should leave, how in the world could 8 million people be logistically removed? That happened once before to Mexican immigrants to this country in the 1930s. And the scars that are on these people were kicked out of the country and then came back. Now, I'm forgetting my Spanish, and it is the Repatriados? I think Repatriados. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com, right at the top, that says listener websites, and there's a website for Repatriados, if I'm anywhere in the ballpark of pronouncing that right or something. You'll see what it is, Spanish word that sounds quite a bit like that. So here are some more of the solutions. This is, now she is a piece of work, Dana Rohrabacher. I say, let the prisoners pick the fruits. She says, kick them all out and then have... She doesn't like the idea like the other guy. They want he wants Mexican slave labor to build this wall. She wants prison labor to pick the fruit. So what Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers fought for decades for a decent living for farm workers, now they want to replace that with prison labors. These people are cuckoo birds. Yeah, more and more. Remember, and I said, are they hurting or harming our country financially? And I mentioned this last time. Immigrants provide as much as $7 billion a year into Social Security. So, let's see. God, they've got so much here. It's just absolutely amazing. Oh, yeah. Here's where we start getting to the problem. According to the Wall Street Journal, this is from David Sirota. Go to SirotaBlog.com or just Google David Sirota, S-I-R-O-T-A. He quotes the Wall Street Journal. Corporate pre-tax profits jumped 14.4%, strongest gain since 1992. So he says, why, oh dear God, why aren't ordinary Americans jumping with joy? And he says, if you take 5 seconds, the 5 seconds it takes to actually look at the underlying data, you see that those profits aren't actually benefiting ordinary workers. That's 99% of this audience, maybe 100%. They are increasingly benefiting only those at the very top of the economic ladder. Now, there is pressure by illegal immigrant workers on the lowest paid native-born Americans. And there's a scramble at the lower level for all these jobs, but it's not what's happening to the people at the industrial level. It's not what's happening to white collar workers that are getting laid off by GM. It's part of a whole globalization. It's part of a whole nature of the way that the capitalism is readjusting itself, and it's going to readjust itself unless the people of the world unite, and say, hey. We are not going to let the market dictate our wages. Forget that free market stuff when it comes to wages. You know what I say to the free market system? Favunculo! Because we'll all be working at China wages. Because the people that own, the ruling class, the people that rule, the people that make the rules and enforce the rules, they figure they get richer and richer the less they pay us. Makes common sense. It's good business, right? Why pay somebody $15 an hour when you can pay them $1.50 an hour? Makes common sense, doesn't it? If you don't have a heart, if you don't care about communities, if you don't care what happens to people's lives, if you don't care about malnutrition of children, if you don't care about disrupting communities that have been in place for generations, then screw them. Then you got Brian from Taylor saying, hey, they're pricing themselves out of the market. So why don't we just volunteer? I would say there's two options. Well, I guess the three. The first one is just let things go and hope it's not us that get screwed. Because, like I said last week, there'll probably be about a third of us that will maintain middle-class wages. It's got to be somebody to buy all the trinkets that the lower orders are pumping out at these now non-union factories, right? The other thing would be to, we could just kind of surrender and say, let's just, gear down our lifestyle right now so we don't have to have the rug pulled out for under us, or we could fight back. And if you're thinking, how the hell do I fight back? It's just me. I don't belong to a union. And if you're saying I belong to a union, I'm not doing anything. What do I do? I don't know. I have no idea, but we better think of something fast. That's all that I have to say about that. That's not true. I have a lot more to say. Let's see. All right. So, in other words, according to David Sirota, in other words, the amount being pocketed by corporations as opposed to being shared with their employees is the highest it's been in 40 years, a situation we already knew was occurring thanks to earlier statistics showing workers' wages are stagnating. And that's good. We used to think as productivity and wealth accumulation increased, we'd get more money. But it's the opposite is happening. And when you see the kind of situation that's occurring, like at Delphi, when the gains of three generations are going to be thrown in the toilet, not because of workers, but because of the management. They're the guys that screwed things up. Oh, somebody wanted a middle-class wage. Oh, how terrible they are. Let's see. How did this happen? Companies have been able to create this inequality, say economists, by sharing less with workers, says the journal. It highlights the increased power of corporate America versus labor. That's all of us. You don't have to be in a labor union to be labor. You're workers. We're all workers. It doesn't matter whether you're wearing a T-shirt like me or a suit tomorrow morning or, you're working in a factory. We're labor. This is a reflection of the global competition that labor now faces in America. So this is, and leading the charge, I mean, you would think it would just be the bosses, right? But no, you have the able aid of somebody like Brian from Taylor. A working class suburb. He's in a working class job, and he's calling for people's wages to be reduced. Why? Because he's resentful. This is the politics of resentment. This is when the people at the bottom begin fighting one another. And that's what's happening with this immigration stuff. They're the cause of our problems. No, it's the Protestants. No, it's the Catholics. No, it's the Jews. No, it's the Muslims. We always find out that it's someone other than the people at the pinnacle of the pyramid. These 793, mostly men, about probably 98% men, who control, those almost 800 men control 1.7 trillion dollars of wealth. They have the capacity that everybody in this world could make a decent living, they could end disease, they could end hunger, they could end the erosion of the environment. There's enough wealth in this world that nobody has to suffer. They can end wars. That no one has to suffer the travail that we take for granted on this planet. But it is this intense greed. And, well, it's not just that. It's not just a character failing, although I would say great numbers of these men have the character failing of greed. But it is the nature of the system that says that, remember, this is the melting pot. Those on the bottom get burned, the scum rise to the top. And, oh, yeah, let me see if I can find this. Here is Brian's advice to any of you being laid off. These stories are heartbreaking, unless they're a conservative. And I say to the conservative, favuncolo, right? This woman, Lisa Simpson, and here someone else in this, where does it say her name in here? Tracy Huffman. Who worked at, she's laid off from Delphi. They're just screwed. Bye. You're out of here. And who else is screwed? Delphi. No retiree health benefits anymore. Too bad. Maybe you can find a clinic that will take you rather than having sweated for 30 years in a factory. And then it's just too bad. And this is cutting costs from the Bryans of the world. But he said, how about this? No one's forcing anyone to work in a factory. Oh, man, you're such an idiot. I just can't even believe it. Why do people work in factories all across the world? Why do people go down into coal mines? Because it's a system based on blackmail. There's these awful jobs that people only do because they're forced to. Who's going to work in some of these death-dealing industries if it wasn't for the coercion of wages that not only is a working class created, but also a sacrifice class, that the health and lives of millions of people, since the capitalist industrial system began, forfeited their lives and their health and their enjoyment of life because of the blackmail of saying, you work in these hideous jobs or you die. That's it. So, but according to Brian here, you're not forced to work in a factory. This is America. If you think the executives are making too much money for the amount of work they do, become an executive. God. So, well, maybe that's what the 8 million illegal immigrants should do. They should all become executives. And all of the 500 people that got laid off by GM should become executives as well. And let's see, maybe the 23,000 union workers that are going to be laid off by Delphi should become executives, and the 8,500 salaried workers should become executives. You see how stupid this thinking is? I mean, it just, I don't even know what to say. All right, let's take a break. I'll be back to get your calls, promise. 313-298-WRIF.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tune for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Lie, lie, pants on fire. How many lies you tell today? One for Iraq, one for pollution, one to attack the Constitution. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Lie to the people and you lie to your friends. And you lie and it never ever ends. Tell me why do you lie, lie, lie? When you lie, 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 do you try to keep a straight face? Liar, pants on fire. Puppet of the gun lobby, drug lobby, bank lobby. Puppet of the war and the more war lobby. Lie about the Wall Street mass corruption. Lie about the weapons of mass destruction. Lie about the lies of Scotland Yard. And you lie about your time in the National Guard. Tell me why, tell me why. Tell me why do you lie, lie, lie? When you lie, 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 do you never have a straight face? Lie to the people and you lie to your friends and you lie and you lie and it never ever ends. Truth about Saddam Hussein. Lie about your drunk driving and your cocaine. Lie about Medicare. Lie about the vets. Lie about everything the rich man gets. You liar, liar, pants on fire. Liar, 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 liar,
All right, thank you. That's from Impeach Me, Songs That Trash the Bushevics by Eskit, E-S-K-I-T. It doesn't even appear to be a, oh yeah, here it is, E-S-K-I-T-X.com, E-S-K-I-T-X.com. And there's tons of songs on there like that. Hi, Peter Werby here with you, 313-298-WRIF. Robert from Port Huron says it was Senator Patrick Leahy that Cheney told to go F yourself. God. And these are the people leading our country. All right. Oh, yeah. Here's an email from Ed in St. Clair Shores. He says, let's see. The English invaded North America, killed off most of the natives. Wayne County was named after Mad Anthony Wayne, a psychotic Indian killer, which is true. That's why they called him Mad Anthony Wayne. The first use of germ warfare was at Fort Detroit, where the English gave peace blankets to the Indians laced with smallpox. Then they kicked the Mexicans out of California, Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico. We have been invading country after country ever since, and those damn illegals have the nerve to cut in line just because their families are living in shacks and irrigation ditches. Shame on them, he says. I think he's being facetious there. All right, we're having a little bit of difficulty, so I can see your calls, but I can't see your name, so I'm just going to have to take these in order by the time they came in. All right, here's our first caller. Hi, welcome. You're on the air. Who's this?
This is Mike Gibson calling.
Mike, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. By the way, Peter, I ran into a friend of yours over at Caribou Coffee in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Well, please don't say his last name. What?
Well, I don't remember his name, but he claims like he's a good friend of yours, and like I just thought I'd bring that.
Sure. No, we've got a lot of good friends. Go ahead.
But anyways, I want to talk about the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code movie is coming out, and supposedly.
Sure.
I guess the Catholic Church and the Evangelical Church is up in arms about it. Supposedly they don't want people to see it because it's creating controversy. It's this thing that they claim it's supporting heresies about the life of Jesus. Supposedly that he supposedly had relations with Mary Magdalene and had children with her and
right.
had a bloodline and
right.
But I guess there's a whole series of books other than the Da Vinci Code book like. Like if you go into Barnes and Noble or Borders Bookshop, they'll have the Da Vinci Code book on the table, and then right next door to that is a whole series of books, similar books about the subject. Like
yeah, they have the Church of Mary Magdalene and all that. Yeah, Dan Brown, the author of the Da Vinci Code, which I read and actually should make a great movie, very exciting and pretty anti-church. So I can understand why they're getting upset. But he's being sued in England for plagiarism, saying that the idea, the core ideas of the book, not any of the language or the kind of potboiler chase scenes and all that are taken, but that there is a number of books out about that. In fact, I get them sent to me every once in a while from Inner Traditions Press. I think that's the publisher. So if you're into that kind of stuff for real, you can go there. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Hey, by the way, we were going to talk about immigration, but let's do that. I bet you're probably going to talk about that. I was going to talk a little more about religion. Hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air on WRIF. Who's this?
Steve, how you doing?
Steve, hi. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Detroit.
Go ahead.
Hey, I think that's a great saying that Scalia's got. That pretty much sums up the whole Bush administration.
Favuncolo!
You know? Yeah, they just love doing that to the people and not really giving a care about what the mass public has to say about any of their philosophies or the way they're running the government right now.
Yeah.
But get back to the UAW thing. I'm a mid entry-level supervisor at one of the big three. And, you know... Well, the company I work for, and I'm not going to say which particular company, but, you know, the way they're treating these people right now is just totally out of control. For example, Delphi, they went into bankruptcy, and if you look, they went into bankruptcy before the new bankruptcy laws passed. So all these top executives are going to make millions and millions of dollars by getting this company bankrupt.
Yeah.
They actually are getting benefited by running a company into the ground and losing 23,000 jobs.
Yeah, they're not ever the ones that are going to suffer. The upper echelons of all this, the Steve Miller, not the Steve Miller of classic rock fame, but the Steve Miller, the CEO, the chief executive officer of Delphi, he and his pals, in fact, they even rewarded themselves with several million dollars in bonuses. And people said, well, wait a minute, isn't this kind of contradictory? And they said, well, we want to keep these people on in the leadership. The leadership, they're the people that sank the damn thing.
Exactly.
Joe and Jane on the line didn't sink it. They did what they were told.
Exactly. And the thing with that is that they're giving themselves all these bonuses, and yet at the same time, now they're talking about cutting completely out benefit for retirees. They're retired.
No, that's they're proposing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I seen that in the paper yesterday, and I couldn't believe it.
How would you like to be 75 years old, and suddenly you and your spouse are facing... No, well, you always go on Medicare, I guess, yeah. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I have my screen up here, and because of a little technical glitch, I cannot see, even though Brandon is putting it up there, I can't see it on my end. So if you would, please, when you come on, I say hi, you're on the air, you say hi. This is, whoever you are. I can't even think of a name. All right, I want to give you a little more on this immigration stuff myself, but here, let me get some of your opinions as well. Hey, it's WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, I'm calling because I have a friend. I'm going to keep this friend's name protected because he or she could lose their job if they found out, like, they told me this.
Mm-hmm.
But this person works for a company that grades state aptitude tests around the country.
Okay.
And one of the tests from Arkansas, I believe, one of the essay questions, there was two essay questions. One of the essay questions said something like, if you had one extra vacation day from school, what would it be? And most of the kids primarily picked 2 days. One was Valentine's Day, which it happened, they happened to take the test like a week before Valentine's Day. And the second one was 9/11.
Huh.
Which doesn't make sense. But when they were giving the explanations why they picked 9/11, it almost seemed like kid after kid was saying because Iraq attacked America, that Saddam Hussein flew the planes into the World Trade Center's test after test after test.
That's pretty sad.
So it's not like, you know, some kids have it messed up, but it seemed like almost every kid who picked 9/11, or the vast majority of them who picked 9/11, said Iraq attacked us. And not only did they say that, they said that's the day the war began on the war on terrorism. And I'm thinking here, what schools are they going to that these kids think that Iraq attacked America?
You know, this people are going to take offense to this and say, you know, I hear why don't you go somewhere else. But the United States, I mean, this is demonstrably so. Has the most, most uninformed, populace of any Western industrial country. It is beyond, you know, we always say number one. Well, there it is. Number one in that. All right. Thanks a lot. Bree writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com answering Brian from Taylor, who spoke about lazy UAW janitors. You know, we talked about this a little because he'd written the first part of this message a while ago, last week. And it's this image. Think of this. It's in the singular. A lazy UAW janitor. I mean, this guy, how does he know? He's ever been in a plant? Anyways, Bree writes, if you want to reduce labor costs, you have to go to the healthcare industry and root out fraud and corruption that inflates costs and premium. If you want further reduce labor costs, you have to go to the corporate executives and root out fraud and corruption of pension funds and fundings. His comment about lazy janitors is the all too common idea that all of our problems would be solved if we would mistreat laborers and remove their incentive to show up and be productive. Rock on. Yeah, I agree. I mean, talk about the lack of human solidarity, let alone like class solidarity, to understand that we are similarly situated in front of this juggernaut that is going for our jugular to reduce our standards, good portions of this population, and all we can say is, oh, it's lazy UAW janitors, oh, it's the illegals, oh, it's, you know, this group or that group. You just don't get it if you're, if you're at that level of thinking. But before we go too much farther, let me talk about those people. Well, those people, the people from Mexico that are coming here, as you know, and when anyone stops and thinks about it, is coming here for only one reason, and that's for economic reasons. And they're doing so because of the desperate straits in which they find themselves in Mexico. So some people have said, well, why don't they go there and make their country good? Well, our country has been looting that country. I mean, first and foremost, looted a good section of the northern portion of Mexico in this imperialist land grab in the 1850s. And economically, it's been exploited like the United States has exploited all of this hemisphere economically. And it has not stopped, even though that there, when he was Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, he's like equal to George Bush when they meet and what have you. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico. Which was pretty much forced upon them, was supposed to do a couple of things. It was, among other things, it was supposed to raise the whole level of the country economically and raise the wages of Mexican workers. The exact opposite has happened. The country has fallen economically. It's in worse shape before NAFTA, directly directly as a result of NAFTA, because it allows further penetration of U.S. capital into Mexico. So what that means, there's investments by U.S. firms in Mexico, like, gee, can I think of any, like Ford, for instance, that figures, hey, we're going to go down there, and we're going to pay people 10% of what we have to pay them here. And so now Mexico imports more cars into the United States than goes the other way, for instance. Also, what's occurred, and wages have dropped. Wages have dropped significantly because of NAFTA. The other thing that's happened is that the Mexican government used to pay subsidies to small corn farmers, corn being the staple grain of traditional Mexican cuisine, for tortillas and lots of other stuff as well. Good, healthy corn grown on small farms. Well, because of a lot of reasons, they were becoming uneconomical, and the government of Mexico began to subsidize it. They were told they couldn't do this under NAFTA, and now, I don't understand that, because the United States does that with its farmers. We give them billions of dollars not to grow stuff and to crop subsidies and stuff like that. Anyway, thousands and thousands and thousands of small farms and traditional villages have gone out of business. The little communities are deserted. And, of course, family farms have disappeared in this country because of the same forces of agribusiness. So where do these people go? They flood into the cities. And this is happening worldwide, as these subsistence economies where people actually could live okay. Because what do you really need? All you need is a house, something to food, something to keep yourself warm if you're in a cool climate, and culture. And they had all that, particularly the latter. And it didn't revolve around television. It wasn't American Idol. It wasn't who could dance the best of the stars or anything like that. It was a long-standing tradition of people know who they were, and they knew their connection to the land. And they knew how to continue that and support that. Well, now that's all gone. That's all destroyed. So they flood into cities like Mexico City that could have 21 million people, 22 million people, 23 million people. They don't know how many. And imagine the waste that comes out of that. So they have hundreds, maybe thousands of acres of garbage dumps. And they have probably a good million people living in the garbage dumps. And one of the ways they survive is they go through the detritus, the leftovers, the crap that the more affluent leave. So some of the most, what would you call it? I can't think of the word. I keep thinking energetic. The most motivated people. This is always what these conservatives are talking about. They don't have motivation. So their motivation is to come to the United States and hang drywall or do painting or work in the service industry and make some money so that their families don't have to live on garbage dumps. And the reaction of some of these conservatives is round them all up. Can't get all 8 million, so we're going to get 6 million. Put them in barbed wire camps and force labor to build a wall to keep them out of our country. Well, this problem is pretty deep, folks, and it has its reflections in what's going on in France, where there's an attempt to erode job security there. It's what's happening in the Detroit area here with white-collar and blue-collar workers being laid off. It's people that thought they could work this miserable job in some lousy factory for 30 years, and at least when they turned 55 or 60, they could sit back at Higgins Lake and know that everything was taken care of, that they had a pension and they had health care. Now, on the other hand, look at the stock market. Pick up the Wall Street Journal and see all the money that's being made, all the wealth that's available. Look at those figures that I said, almost 800 men controlling almost $2 trillion worth of wealth that they don't let loose of. And when people try to do that, when people say, you're not paying your workers very well, you're part of sweatshops, what you're selling is part of sweatshops in Asia, that you're hiring illegal workers at the same time you're critical of it. You have no benefits whatsoever. and your owners are billionaires. I mean, could you stand up to that if you were a multi-billionaire and you understood that because of your tight-fisted, ham-handed, hard-hearted policies, that people, not only your workers, but people across the world were suffering, and you realized that you could even give up as much as 90% of your fortune and still have enough to live more lavishly than anyone ever has in the history of the world, wouldn't you do it? Wouldn't you do that? I sure would. And you'd still have hundreds of millions of dollars left. But not the Waltons. Not the family that owns Walmart. Their reaction to the fact that they've been heavily criticized for everything that I mentioned before is they are now hiring sort of war rooms to rebut critics. And they're even spending money. They're giving like Andrew Young $1 million to put up a statue. What the hell? Is it of Martin Luther King? Maybe. Something like that. So, because they know that's cheaper in the long run. They can make their customers think, well, these guys aren't so bad. They're doing all of that. But wages, health benefits, treatment of workers? No. We're going to set up a public relations reaction to this all. And I'll tell you what, folks. Most of you, I believe, are probably thinking, this is pretty horrible. Why does this have to be like this? Why at the bottom are people fighting one another and calling for the kind of things that they are? Why are women, young girls, 14, 15 years old, working in sweatshops in Asia, putting together the chipboards for our little toys and computers and ruining their eyesights and being kept in barracks? Why does this have to be? And there's people among us, though, that are just like us that say, why don't they work hard and become an executive? It's really sick. All right, let's go back to our phones. This is WRIF, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. This is Al from Inkster.
Hi, Al. Should I tell you how I really feel?
No.
Okay.
Keep it hidden.
I will. Go ahead. You're on the air.
You remember the old cowboy humorist Will Rogers?
Well, I don't remember him, but I know he existed.
They had the same debate over immigrants, and he was arguing with some patrician senator who traced his lineage back to the Mayflower, and he looked at him and said, my people, never should have let your people off the boat.
Well, right.
We're all illegal immigrants in this country.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, that is the case. I'm getting corrected here on how to say, I'm saying favunculo, and Anna writes in, vafunculo, vafunculo, okay, vafunculo, that's what I said.
Let's go to the Hispanic side and just call them all pinches.
Yeah, pendejos.
That's right.
All right.
Especially the rich ones that exploit us for all of the money and then blame the immigrants for taking the jobs when they're the ones that are shipping them overseas to cover up their own mistakes.
You got it, Al. Thanks. Appreciate it. Now, what are we talking about? I mean, why are we going on with this? If you're just joining us, Antonin Scalia, inside the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston, was asked, what do you say to people who say that you're prejudiced on the question of separation of church and state? And he said, "I say," and I got it now. I'm not gonna vafunculo, vafunculo. I got it. Favunculo. Yeah, that's right. And he says that's Italian for "f you." Except he said the word in the Holy Cross Church. Well, I say to him, "No, this is intimidating me." Vafunculo. Vafanculo. That's right. Vafanculo. That's right. That's easier to say. Vafanculo. Anna's an ex-Ann Arborite out here in Los Angeles who remembers you from back in the day, the morning of the day, to be specific. Well, write me again and remind me, Anna. Anna, I should say then, right, if we're going to say Vafanculo. No, I'm saying it wrong. Vafanculo. All right. Whatever. All right. Do we have time for one more call? Yeah, we do. Let's see here. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, hello.
Hi. Who's this?
This is Chuck in Waterford.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I was just calling just to really, my friends and I have been talking about, you know, what's going on in the news, all this stuff about illegal aliens and getting them out of the country and stuff, and The whole thing is, I don't get it, because what has changed over the past month or 10 months or 10 years?
There you go. That's the big question, right?
Right. Bush is just blowing smoke at us so that we, you know, get confused about what the real issues are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the whole thing, the fact that Bush is in office and not impeached leads me to believe that our whole democratic system is breaking down.
But listen, I don't want to diminish the fact, though, I don't think you should either, and I'm not saying you are, that there are this is an enormous problem. I mean, but it's one of dozens and dozens of problems, and it's nowhere near the top of the list. If immigrant labor is hurting this country, it's on a fairly minor basis as a country as a whole. I mean, there's a lot of people that where these, you know, entry points are. Have some real issues, but it has to do with a whole hemisphere that's totally out of whack, maybe the whole world.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean that Bush is probably planning on paying Halliburton to build a wall along the Mexican border, but, you know, I mean, we're not having a problem with the Canadians, are we?
No, that's if the slave labor that some of these Republicans want to employ to build the wall doesn't work out, eh?
You know, yeah, like, you know, I spent some time in Saudi Arabia, and over there the Saudis walked around and were in charge of everything, didn't know how anything worked, but they had all these people from Ceylon and India and you know, the Philippines that were doing all the jobs for them.
Well,
these guys would come in and work, you know, they'd work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, and stay there for 6 months, do it, go home, visit their family, come back for, you know, another 6 months.
You know, that's one of the problems, though, and Paul Krugman in the New York Times talked about this. He said, imagine for a moment a future in which America becomes like Kuwait or Dubai, a country where a large fraction of the workforce consists of illegal immigrants or foreigners on temporary visas, and neither group has a right to vote. Surely this would be a betrayal of our democratic ideals of a government of the people, by the people. Moreover, a political system in which many workers don't count is likely to ignore workers' interests. It's likely to have a weak social safety net and to spend too little on services like health care and education. So there are some downsides to it. All right, we'll take a break. Be right back. In the meantime, you want to call 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And at 1 a.m., we're going to have some interviews. One will be about this very question about immigration. And I'll, as we say in school, I'll get my thinking cap on, and actually who it is will pop into my little brain. And the reason I can't remember all of this is I just have this enormous pile of articles and notes and stuff like that, all of your emails, which I haven't been getting very well to. But if you'd like to call right now for the first time tonight, there's open line, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. Emails, which I will get to eventually, if at least just to read myself, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, but I'll try to get to some of them. Here's one that's interesting. Last week, Jacob called from Oulu, Finland, and I thought, man, got a listener in Finland, probably about 5 a.m. there, 6 a.m., 7 a.m., who knows, you know, tomorrow morning. And so I thought it was pretty unique to have a listener to the Night Call show in Finland. But, hey, listen to this. Now, I don't know how to pronounce this name. In fact, I'm not sure. It's not signed like that, but it's Ironine, I-R-O-I-N-E, maybe the name, Ironine. I've been listening to your show for some time now and was surprised to hear a Finnish person calling in during the last show. And while I largely agree with the few positive things the caller said, a few balancing notes might be in order. So wait a minute. I'm going to read something about Finland. Here, Finland, Jacob told us that this sounded like near paradise. High minimum wage, huge safety net, guaranteed weeks off, full health care for everybody paid for the government, by the government, and very environmentally conscious policies. And so anyways, this goes on. For example, the minimum wage in Finland is agreed separately for different fields of work, and the rock bottom is about $6.50, and so the $20 mentioned certainly sounds way too high, according to Jacob. Also, the future doesn't look all that rosy in many respects. The Nordic social democratic system is heavily under attack from the neoliberal side. Jobs are moving to Asia. Now, neoliberalism isn't the kind of, when we talk about people are liberals, that they're talking about policies to help people. Neoliberalism is this globalization where restrictions on what they consider trade are all removed, and policies that are based mostly, to, almost exclusively, to benefit investment and not the people who are affected by it. So this is happening in these countries that have what's called social democratic systems. Some people call it socialism. It's capitalist society. But what they have are incredible amounts of social programs to make people's life so they don't see what we have in this country. You don't have, like I just read a little earlier today, this whole new group of people that live in their cars. That's where they live. They live in their cars. And they're called the mobile, I don't know if I can even find this now, that's what I'm saying, the mobile homeless, that's it, or mobile homeless or something like that. Can't find it. Anyways, let's see. The jobs are moving to Asia. The population of Finland is getting older. The political left is slowly drifting to the right, even if people's opinions aren't. The pressure is on to privatize public services and so on. Having said that, currently things are indeed still pretty good. For example, as a student, I get free university education and benefits big enough to cover practically all living costs. And one only has to talk to students from other countries to appreciate the generosity of such a system. Why don't we have free university costs for everyone here? Why don't we have free universities? We have free high schools, at least now. Well, we have a war to pay for instance. We have the rich not paying taxes worthy of what they make. Corporations not paying enough. Finally, our friend from Finland says, your show offers an interesting glimpse at the social situation in America, illustrates the threats we may also face and what is to be expected if we're overcome by those threats, and thus serves as an effective reminder of how important it is to defend the social democratic model in this corner of the world and to preserve and improve it for future generations. I've much enjoyed your style, knowledge of history and social issues, and your ability to unspin the right-wing spin and to educate people and do it in an entertaining way. Well, thank you. Keep up the good work. That's one of the things that's happening in France, for instance. They're talking about unraveling the social benefits there. And that's why people are out in the streets in those numbers. But it is so important to the ruling class to enforce what they call labor discipline or labor reforms, that they want to reduce what people can expect for their life. Think about how much of our life we give over to labor. Years ago, there was, all of a sudden I can't remember the figure. It could have been 6 hours work for 8 hours pay. That was like in the late 50s and early 60s. Productivity and wealth accumulation had reached such a point as people were saying, why are we working 8 hours a day? Now it's going the other way, right? Hi, this is Night Call. Peter Werby with you. You're on the air. Who's this?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
I'm from Trenton, and I just wanted to say about the factory workers and stuff.
Yeah.
How it's affecting their lives. My mother, she works in a steel plant, and she works 7 days a week most of the year. And she's worked so many doubles that she only gets about 4 hours of sleep a day.
Wow. That's not the way people should have. You know what that sounds like, Kevin? It sounds like the 19th century. Before unions. Are you in a bowling alley?
Yeah, I'm working right now.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm sorry for the noise. I'm trying to get to the quieter end.
That's okay. Yeah. This sounds like something out of the 19th century, and we're going back to that. What thousands of people have literally died for, shot down in the street by cops and National Guards and private guards, like what they used to call the Pinkertons, in order to have working people get a decent standard of living. And we're back to what you just described about your mother. I just read a letter from people in Finland, or not people, but a listener in Finland, and that it, there's no way in the world that that would be allowed. And plus, they probably get 5 or 6 weeks of vacation. All right. Thanks a lot. It is a little too noisy, so I'm going to move on. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, who's this?
Dan in Port Huron.
Hi, Dan.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
I'm going to switch gears real quick for you. Maybe you can elaborate on this for me.
Sure.
I'm 27 years young, and I've heard you discussing, you know, things like factory work and the economy and how just families all over are struggling. Well, a new window of opportunity has been opened to me through a friend, and that's truck driving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the expanding job market for truck drivers, you know, you got all these retiring truck drivers that are, you know, 55, maybe even older, spending, you know, even months on the road away from their families, and all this stress takes its toll.
Sure.
I got in a big debate, you know, in 48 hours, I'm going to be going over the road with my friend as an observer, so he can kind of give me some pointers before I step into this market, so to speak. And we got in a big heated debate, you know, with friends. You talk about everything, war, jobs, price, the oil price, everything. And I'm wondering, you know, with the bottleneck that we live in, where I'm at in Port Huron, we got all this traffic on the bridge.
Right.
We got I-94 and 69, you know, there are only two business routes in and out of the city. I'm thinking, you know, even with an expanding market such as truck driving, you know, that's going to have its toll on the economy too, maybe for the negative, maybe for the positive.
Uh-huh.
So while, you know, in a year or two, maybe more, I might land a good job and make some money, I'm just worried, really, what's further down the road.
I have no idea. I know.
I'll let you elaborate on that and get back to your callers.
Okay, so I appreciate that. Well, you know, I'll tell you, there's not much I can elaborate on. I can't look into a crystal ball. I don't know how industries are going to expand or what kind of what section of labor is going to be rewarded well. But things do not look good in general. So the more skills you have, the better. I mean, other than these idiots that keep saying they got to retrain, and then the industry you retrain to turns out to be shipped over to India or something like that. But right now, if you can get into something, get a skill, hell, that seems like a pretty good idea. All right, thanks a lot. Andy writes in from Windsor to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm unclear of your position on the subject. Do you side with the immigrant labor and keep them in, or do you think we should make them legal or ignore the problem? Also, what do you think of the hardline comments made by Lou Dobbs all last week? Well, I would rather watch my washing machine than Lou Dobbs. And those are, you know, those are the kind of programs that don't allow people to think real clearly. And they're really demagogues, just pretty much interested in getting high ratings. And it's what I said at the beginning of it. I mean, do I have to have a position? What do I think? What are the options? Rounding up 8 million people and sending them back? That's ridiculous. Allowing unlimited number of people to continue to come in here that'll then have the effect of working at low wages and have no political say whatsoever? That doesn't sound good. What are the good options? I mean, people say, send them all back. Yeah, arrest all the employers. Go ahead, try it. I mean, go try that. I mean, I shouldn't say that because it would cause such untold human misery. But, yeah, maybe it'll come to that. I mean, I almost wanted to say at some point when Bush was lying about the reasons for the Iraq war, I almost felt like saying, yeah, go ahead. See what'll happen. Except we did see what happened, right? We've seen this country destroyed. Tens of thousands of innocent civilians killed by the Americans. Thousands of Americans killed because of Bush's policies. Hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax dollars sent to Halliburton and Carlyle Group and whatever else it takes to run a war. And probably hundreds of millions, as we know, just stolen. Just stolen. So what do I think? I don't know. What the hell? Wait a minute here. We got a debate coming. Jacob is calling in from Finland. Actually, he's writing in. Dear Peter, because I just read this other letter from Finland. The writer is right. The figure of the minimum wage is agreed mainly between the unions and the employee, but he has taken a single value in his calculation. I'm going to have to read this. This may be too complex to read on the air, Jacob, but I will check it out during our next break. All right, which is a little while from now. So if you want to call in, 313-298-WRIF. Oh, let me tell you about this. What was I looking at as I came from home? $2.60 a gallon. Now, Exxon is making these record profits. They're gouging us. All of these oil companies are. The price of crude went up. They would still make the same amount, right? If there was a dollar for crude and it was a dollar, all their costs, and they made a dime, it would be $2.10. Well, if it went up a dime, then it would be $2.20. But the fact that they have record profits means that they're putting the pump price up greater than their increased cost for crude and refining and what have you. I think we all agree on that, right? Bush thinks this is fine. Also, Bush is about to waive $7 billion in royalties due to the United States. So we have this deficit that he's created by his insane economic policies and tax policies of giving money to the ultra-wealthy while we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on war. And here's $7 billion that the government is going to forfeit. So rather than taking it from these big corporations with record profits, it comes from you and me. And rather than the money that we pay in Michigan coming back to us, funneled through the government for things that they can do that you and I can't do as individuals or our communities can't do, it's going to stay in the hands of these already profit-swollen big oil companies. And you know what? Remember what I was saying before? It's the same thing. There's people out there listening saying, he can't take away those corporations' profit. These working-class people, these middle-class people are actually concerned about Exxon's profits that are the greatest in history. And when I say Bush is giving them another $7 billion that either then we're going to have to borrow and pay back, so part of our taxes won't even be for spending on anything, even the war, it'll be for debt service, the interest to foreign banks. I mean, I'll be forever on this. The number could quadruple to more than $28 billion if a lawsuit filed last week challenging one of the program's remaining restrictions proved successful. So these greedy corporations, not only are they making these extreme profits through gouging us, not only is the government, our government, taking our, they're not taking it, that we're relinquishing this money, they also want to get seven times that, or four times that, up to $28 billion. All right, so what's going on here? Who's dealing with that? Well, the populist president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who is destabilizing the region by his mercurial strongman tactics, right? Well, he's taking on ExxonMobil. So who's our pal? Bushco, Bush Incorporated, Bush and Sons Incorporated, or Hugo Chavez, who is put out a blunt message this week for ExxonMobil, one of the world's most powerful oil companies, get off my crude-rich turf. Venezuela tightened its squeeze on the oil industry. Just listen to this language, then we'll go back to it. Venezuela is tightening its squeeze on the oil industry, telling oil companies to give the state a greater share of profits or get out. Man, this guy's pretty evil. He's putting the squeeze on the oil industry. Must be like Hitler. Maybe we should stop him before he invades Colombia or something like that. Well, here's an oil, here's an industry based on squeezing the earth to begin with, and then squeezing the profits, their profits, out of us. And this language by Natalie Pearson, the AP, Associated Press business writer, she employs that language. So this is like something bad. But what Chavez is doing is demanding more of a cut of this foreign investment and less profits going out of the country. Well, ExxonMobil is so profit-swollen, as I said. They're saying, hey, we're not going to do this. But all these other companies, Chevron, is there still Texaco? I can't see if this is here. Also, China, India, Iran even, they're saying, sure. This Spanish-Argentine company, Repsol, they're all saying, yeah, that's fine, because they know they can operate under the terms that the Venezuelan government has set and still make money, still make foreign investment into Venezuela, take out enough investment. But ExxonMobil, no, they want it so much that they can give it to their stockholders at the expense of the poor of Venezuela. Because Chavez isn't using this for his domestic ruling class. That's why they're so pissed off at him. That's why those people hate Chavez so badly and say he's like Hitler and all that. What's he doing? He's like Hitler. Is he rounding up people? No. Is he arresting people? No. Is he shutting down all these newspapers and television stations that are critical of him? No. I have criticism of Chavez, but, you know, at some point you want to ask me, maybe I'll tell you. But he's not doing anything like the critics from the Bush administration and the wealthy of Venezuela are accusing him of. He's actually trying to use the wealth of the country to improve the lot of the poor. And as many of you know, I was in Venezuela in the end of January. And when you see poverty like that, it's incredible in a country that has enormous riches. So he's trying to help the people of his country. One of the reasons, one of the many reasons that the country of Mexico is so poor is for many years it was the same deal, that that foreign companies, even though that was the oil is owned by the government in Mexico, it was still these deals that benefited the Mexican ruling class and foreign capital. So this is going on. You know, this is going on. But also, there's another presidential candidate to add to Morales in Bolivia and Lula in Brazil that aren't going to stand anymore for the way that their countries have functioned essentially as troughs for these corporations to feed at. And it's not even helping us, at least before, when the United States 100 times invaded Latin America beginning in like 1900 to secure corporate interests. They said, wow, man, we're directly benefiting. It's not even that, because they're still looting that region of the world, these corporations, U.S. corporations, and our standard of living is going down to the point where we're fighting with illegal Mexican immigrants for who's going to get the crap jobs. And if we want to fight poor Mexicans rather than understanding that it's the whole way that social relationships, economic relationships, political relationships are administered throughout the world, and that we have this pyramidal system with this small elite controlling everything and everybody, I just don't know what to say. Anyways, Ollanta Humala, who's running for the president of Peru, he says, we nationalists are going to found a new country. Who's afraid of change? Are the people afraid of change? No. Those who are afraid are the ones in power because they know if the nationalists get to power, Peru will change. And you could almost say, you could say the same thing about this country as well. All right, let's go on. Peter Werbe here with you on WRIF. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. And welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air. Who's this?
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, hi.
Hi, this is Jesse. I'm calling from Yale, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the immigration.
Sure. Can you turn your radio off, Jesse?
Oh, sure can.
Yeah,
oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I think there's a lot of things being said both ways about the immigration and the immigrants that are here. In a way, we all are immigrants. And the U.S. allows so many people to come in on visas, and they can bring certain family members with them, and, like, the whole family gets a visa. You know, how many different diversities do we have here? How many places can you go? How many stores or restaurants or hotels do you go to that aren't owned by American people, and yet we still go there? So a lot of people get upset about the immigrants being here, and yet we're still giving them our money. We're still allowing them to be here, and nobody's really doing anything about it.
No, wait a minute. Why shouldn't we go to stores that are owned by people that are immigrants or that are here legally? I mean, that, you know, as you said, all of us were. It used to be in the 1840s that they would say job opening, no Irish need apply. And in the 1890s in New York, the chief of police said that Jews were criminal by nature and had to always be watched. The Italians were called WOPs, without papers. And so immigrants, no matter what it says at the base of the Statue of Liberty, immigrants have never been very welcomed by people who have been here for a generation or so. And then they become immigrated, and then they become integrated into our society. And we say, how come they dress funny? How come they talk funny? How come they, you know, they look funny? And then they become a regular part of America. And then the next group comes along, and we say the same damn things about
them. Yep, exactly. And it's really funny because we all, well, look at how we were accepted when, you know, the Mayflower landed, how the Indians took them, you know. We're all immigrants in a way, and to try to do something about it now, when that's what our country was founded on and from, it's kind of, how can you really do anything about it? Yeah, there's people over here legally, but there's also millions of them over here on visas from the government that we're allowing to be here and are right in mainstream society, and nobody gives them a second thought. And, you know, it's kind of funny to me, you know, when you go to schools and you see all the different kinds of kids there, that's okay for them to be there.
Sure.
But then when you're looking at the job market and the people that are working, well, those people wouldn't be able to find a job if the American people were doing them.
That's right. Thank you, Jesse. I appreciate it. And the other thing is, too, is some of these stores or hotel chains, these are people that bought them and they work hard and they do it. And, a diversity. Hey, I like it. I'm an American mongrel mostly, so I don't have any real solid culture of my own. And as I said earlier, most Americans don't. Our culture is all what we watch on television. And people that have wonderful food and interesting festivals, I love it. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. This is Pierre in Windsor. I wonder if he calls himself, I know you call yourself Pierre, but there, it was a street, a guy I knew lived on Pierre Street, which I think is on the east side of Windsor in Ontario, folks, if you're listening from far away. So I couldn't find it. So I'm asking people, where is Pierre? Where's Pierre? And no, they looked at me like there wasn't a street, and someone said, oh, you mean Peary? P-I-E-R-R-E. It's because the Anglophones, yeah, the people who speak English, they, they anglicize all these words. So, obviously, Windsor's a predominantly English-speaking city. But even in Montreal, the English minority, they insist. I'm trying to remember what, but they take these French words, and even though the overwhelmingly French population, French-speaking population of Quebec, say that with the proper French pronunciation, they insist on saying it with this, English, Englandization of it. So It's, I think it's Pierre, not Perry. Anyways, free and free university education in Finland. This is what a Finnish listener told us earlier. What a concept. Same thing in France. Didn't know that that until I actually lived there. Lesson learned. When they can get away with it in North America, it's because we're so ignorant to the outside world. Ignorance is indeed bliss, says Pierre. All righty. Let's go on here and go to line one. Hi, this is Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi, who's this?
This is Dave from Lincoln Park.
Okay, go ahead, Dave. You're on the air.
How you doing? Good. Yeah, I was just to say about immigration and that how Bush has got that program. I don't actually agree with that at all because, well, basically what it is like you're instead of outsourcing your jobs over to, like, say, Mexico or somewhere else, you're just keeping the people here for just a short wage. And basically, I don't think that's right at all.
Not, I mean, in other words, you're saying that they're, instead of, like, shipping jobs to Mexico, they're doing the same kind of work here?
Well, no, I mean, they're instead of shipping the jobs over, they're actually just keeping the people here for lower wages. It's not, you know, where the location is, just who's got, you know, how can you make a better profit by exploiting cheap wages.
I'm sorry to put this on you because I couldn't answer the question. Any solutions?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I can't give you one.
I can't either. I can't either. You know, you're supposed to be, hey, you're a smart guy on the radio, me. So I'm supposed to have all the answers because if you listen to CNN or Fox News, you got all these talking heads that say, here's what we should do, everybody, you know,
yeah,
like that.
I know.
And, yeah. So the hardest line, if you think about it, the hardest line reaction to is to deport all these people. And like I said, it would be probably a logistical impossibility and a human rights nightmare to try to do that. And it, you know, ultimately, these people are human beings that have the same goals and aspirations that we do. And what happens is that their kids get born here, so the kids are citizens. So you've got like the 12-year-olds and the 14-year-olds can stay, but mom and dad, they're being rounded up and put it on the boxcars and sent back to Sonora or something. All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate your opinion. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Elliot from Detroit.
Hi, Elliot.
I just recently started working for a company, and they're conservatives, lucky me. So in the morning, I don't get a healthy dose of coffee. I get a healthy dose of Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and apparently what this guy's spewing out of his mouth, because I remember what you were saying earlier about Finland, and he's saying that, well, statistics have been taken, and these people that have health care in other countries, they don't like it, you know. So, which is hard for me to believe because I don't have health care right now, and I don't like that. And
well, here's the problem, and which is a problem sometimes in Canada, is that these large social programs, as the letter writer, the email writer said from Finland, all the standards of living are under ferocious attack. And the problem with the Canadian system is it's not funded enough. And what happens is when, you know, that the money starts to flow southward, that there are problems. I guess maybe we should ask the Canadian people. Some Canadians can call in. I've said before, I don't know why Canada has an army. They ought to disband their army. Who are they going to fight?
Yeah.
And people say, oh, well, they go, you know, they're peacekeeping. Well, let somebody else do that. If I was in Canada, I would say, let's disband the army and like Costa Rica. Costa Rica has no army. They have police force. That's not the problem. But they're spending billions, hundreds of billions of dollars on an army. So they get to send, you know, a couple thousand troops to Afghanistan or something like that. They would do better to fund their social programs while they still have them than you know, try to ship around the Canadian Armed Forces. But you know what happens? People say, oh, it's a matter of pride. You know, the Canadian Armed Forces. Screw that. I mean, what would you rather have? Pride in a military that's unnecessary, that's absolutely unnecessary for the defense of the country? There's only one country that's going to invade Canada, and that's the United States, which has, as I've said any number of times before, which has contingency plans to invade and occupy every country in the world. Liechtenstein gets a 3x5 card. There's a complete situation for invading and occupying Canada. In other words, they do it because they would say, well, we don't want to get caught, not shorthand, it would be, you know, say something happened. There is, like, the terrorists took over Canada. We want to say, uh-oh, we better figure out how to do this. They got it all figured out. They've got routes where to put all the whatever needs to be put. Well, all right. I'm going to take a break, I think. So thank you for your call, Elliot. Yeah, I'd rather have a health care myself like that. In fact, that would solve a lot of the problems, wouldn't it? If there was a national health program. But we might not be able to fight wars all across the world. We might not be able to have this archipelago of military bases all across the world. We might not be able to spend $500 billion on this wasteful military that ensures that the small sector of industrial production and wealthy corporations make out from the money we give them through our tax dollars, and we might actually get this all back. What about China? Well, we're spending 10 times a year what they spend on their military, and there could be ways that we maybe investigate that rather than making war, we should try to make peace. George Bush and company, they go the opposite way.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
absolutely over-the-top environmental novel. We usually don't do novels, called Primal Tears. I'm not going to get a chance. Boy, I still can't get my mouth around this Italian word that Justice Scalia said. Favanculo. That's it. Favanculo. And I was going to say it to conservatives. When they gave me a hard time, I was going to just say Favanculo, because he's a conservative. They all admire him and hang up on him. Anyway, Bob writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Illegal immigrants translates to more unemployed and underemployed Americans. I mean, you just can't say that. If they all left, there would be millions of jobs unfilled, as a matter of fact. The continued mass influx of foreign workers who work for less means the continued displacement of legal American workers and a further degradation of benefits for American workers. That has a bit of truth to it, but it is not entirely the case. You just can't say it either. I mean, you have to have statistical proof. I mean, on the face of it, it sounds like that. But you know what? People always said that. They said, these immigrants are coming in, they're taking our jobs. I mean, I've heard that since I've been doing talk radio. But there always is a shifting workforce. Immigration has always been part of it. Because no matter what ethnic group you're part of, unless you got here on the Mayflower, that your ethnic group has always been resented by native-born workers, and the same damn thing was said. Like I said, about Irish going back into the 1840s, if you're German or Italian or Jewish or whatever. He said, yeah, these people are coming in and they're foreign ways and they keep to themselves and they eat funny food and they won't learn English. And, you know, it's the same crap over and over again. I mean, that's not the root of the problem. And again, Bob, I'm not trying to say that this is completely untrue. I'm saying that that's not the root of the problem. We've got to figure out why. Well, it's not so hard to figure out why. It's because they can do it. It's like, why does a dog? I guess I can't say that. Never mind. That why is there a line, an arbitrary line across a piece of land? People make $24 an hour at Ford plant north of it, $2.40 an hour south of it. That's what it's all about. And if you think, I mean, maybe we could get this, I don't know, thousands of miles long wall. We could round up everybody and kick them out. Yeah, that's not going to solve the problem. It's not going to solve the problem. All right, let's see. Let's go back to our phones here. Hi, this is Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, pleasure to speak with you. Yeah, I have one quick comment here. I truly believe that, you know, immigration hasn't been a problem until recently. It was the timing of the protests.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, and the military does this, and I think it was purposely timed at the point that they had their protest, that we wouldn't notice what was going on in another aspect of our government. Apparently, our government is proposing a no-bid contract to Hutchinson Wampapa, which is supposedly a Japanese-based company, but it's actually owned by the communist Chinese. And what we're doing is we're literally turning over our most sophisticated biological and nuclear detection units.
Uh-huh.
Into United States.
You're right. That is going on. You know, I hadn't even, see, it distracts me, too. You're right. That is happening.
And I truly believe that so the American public won't rise up like they did with the Dubai ports. This to me is it goes much deeper than Dubai ports problem. This is communist Chinese. When you give them our most sophisticated nuclear and biological equipment as far as for testing, they're going to reverse engineer it. They're going to find the flaws in it. They're going to know how to bypass it, and they're going to sell that information.
Well, it's all part of a piece, if you think about it. But it is curious that everyone, in this case, myself as well, gets distracted by the baubles that that shine in front of our eyes. And while someone's picking our pockets, and in this case, threatening our security, right?
Oh, tremendously, tremendously. The illegal aliens in this country are not a threat to our security, okay? Prior to 9-1-1, you wouldn't have looked at an illegal alien and thought they were a terrorist. You know, I still today don't do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. You're right. I don't think that's a problem. And if we have, I want to thank you for bringing that up to us. If we have an audience scratching their head thinking like, what the hell is he talking about? And why isn't that right up front of the news? It's something that we ought to be asking ourselves. Why don't we get this information? All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Now, actually, I was looking for one piece of news that I completely lost. I was talking about Chavez and standing up to these big oil companies and saying, hey, here's the way it's going to be. You're not going to continue to loot our country. We're going to take part of the wealth that's produced and use it for the improvement of our country. So for that, he should be admired. The other thing is, and he just put out a statement, I think today, saying that they want to peg the oil at permanently at the price of $50 a barrel. Now, that wouldn't be as low as we would like it. And, you know, it's funny. When I was in Caracas, I never could get the exact price of oil or of gasoline. It was the highest I heard was 40 cents a gallon. That's what they get in Caracas. And that's one of the reasons that people like the government. And where was it? Wait a minute. Yeah, I think that's what it was. 14 cents. That was how much it was. Or it was 14. I can't remember. But it was, and it's not that I can't remember, is that I kept seeing different prices reported. There's something on my website where you can see the world oil prices, and I can't even remember what for sure it says. But in other words, they can pump it out of there and refine it for a pretty low price. But anyways, Chavez wants this Venezuelan crude and to have the same stat. I don't know. This is too complicated. Anyways, he wants to permanently peg it at 50 bucks a barrel, which would reduce it from what it is now. Isn't it over 60 still? So we would get, I mean, remember, some people in other parts of the world are paying $6 a gallon, like in Italy and places like that. So we might permanently have to pay $2 or $2.10, which might be a little inducement to have cars that get good mileage, and you know, maybe we get some bikes out in the summer and all that. But anyways, this is what Chavez is doing for the world. And one of the criticisms that the old ruling class of Venezuela has is that Chavez is giving too much money away. Like, he gives good deals on oil to Caribbean countries. And, you know, he's giving subsidized oil from the Citgo stations to the poor in the Northeast. And they're saying, you know, and the people are saying, oh, look, he's giving away all this stuff. They never cared before, when the rich in Venezuela were cut in on the racket of oil exploration and shipping, they didn't have any problems with that. But now they're not getting their share. So you know what we say to them? Bafunculo, right? I still don't think I have it right. Anyways, Peter Werby here with you for a few minutes, about 15 minutes more. So you can call in 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
This is Jerry from St. Clair Shores.
Hey, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just have one comment about the immigration issue. A comment that I seem to be recurring is they keep using the phrase that these people are willing to do jobs that so-called Americans wouldn't do. But my philosophy on that is they refuse to provide incentive for me to do that job. I think you should get what you paid for. You provide minimum wage, you should get minimal effort. And when these immigrants come in, I feel sorry for them because what they see as opportunity is just another opportunity for them to be exploited.
Sure.
At a minimum wage. And I think as far as solutions to the problem, well, they say a rising tide raises all boats. If we raised minimum standards, wouldn't everyone benefit? Not only the American workers, but the immigrant workers as well?
Absolutely. I was looking for something. I don't know why. You said it very eloquently. I don't know why I have to bother to repeat it. Oh, yeah, here. John Broder, Immigrants and the Economics of Hard Work. They're saying it's asserted both as fact and as argument. The United States needs a constant flow of immigrants to perform jobs Americans will not stoop to do. But he says one of those jobs paid $50 an hour with benefits instead of $7 or $10.
Exactly.
And, well, then people would go, whoa, man, yeah, agricultural work, I'm down with it. The other thing is the majority that immigrants do not predominate in anything other than a few small industries, and even where they do, like I think in agriculture, still it's like 40% still native born Americans. So there's so many myths out there.
Yes, and also they've seemed to, in the capitalist system, they've seemed to replace the theory of incentive with a philosophy of fear. Instead of encouraging me to do better by offering incentive, a higher wage, better benefits, they seem to come back and say, if you don't do it, we'll give it to someone else. Or take less to keep what you have.
No, as I said, this is a system that's always been based on blackmail, essentially.
Yeah, well, I think the system itself is a good ideal. It's proven itself again and again, but it's been corrupted and perverted and turned into something that it's just not what it was meant to be.
Yeah, and also what it very well could be as well. There's no reason for all of this other than a system that has allowed the parking of the commonwealth of the world in the hands of extraordinarily small people, small number of people, to the vast detriment of billions. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Hey, one of the things that people are talking about, have to have stepped up security. Get this. A Zogby poll of U.S. and Canadian residents. Now, those of you that are listening around the country, other than in the Detroit area where we're broadcasting from and across the world, you have to understand that we're right on the Canadian border here. And we go to Canada pretty frequently. And right now, we don't even need a passport. I think we're going to at the end of the year. But you can just a birth certificate. And before, you didn't even need that, you know, up until 9/11. But anyway, a Zogby poll of U.S. and Canadian residents along the border shows that U.S. proposals to increase security measures by making border crossings more difficult could cost both economies dearly. One estimate cited by the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce, this is all Republicans and businessmen, which commissioned the Zogby poll, put lost revenue at more than $2 billion per year because fewer people said they would go through the hassles of increased security to visit the neighboring country. As it is, it's a pain in the ass to come back to the United States because they're always, hey, wait a minute. No, I'm sorry, guys, because I know a lot of these guys. No, I know you guys are swell. Actually, they don't do any more than they're required to do. Canada, boom, you just get through like that. But you go across the bridge, there's hardly anybody on the bridge, and you figure that'll be one or two cars. You go there, and there's 40 cars in front of you, something like that, or maybe not 40. But it's always a jam. Actually, they never give me a hard time, unless I know the guys that listen to the show. Then they want to talk about the show. But I roll up there, like my wife and I. We were just there, my wife and I, and dog. So dog, they want to have license and papers showing they have shots. So I'm sitting there in line, and people are there for like 10 minutes. I'm thinking, what the hell are they talking to him about? And I roll up, and they say, where you been? I said, Canada. Where'd you visit a friend? Okay. Whew. I don't know. Maybe I don't look threatening. Majority of both Americans and Mexicans are opposed to building a wall on the Mexican border to cut illegal immigration to the U.S. Trouble on both borders stems from ongoing American anxiety over the potential for another terrorist attack, said pollster John Zogby. With new border regulations due to go into effect between the U.S. and Canada in 2008, that would require a valid passport. Canada stands to lose 20% of its American business, and U.S. businesses stand to see a 15% drop in Canadian traffic. The other thing, this is nuts. Now, the customs agents that are listening to this, the statute of limitations is passed. You'll have to accept this. But I have entered Canada illegally, any number of times. I've illegally entered on boats, mainly, across the Detroit River. Did it once in a kayak. Did it once in a sailboat. Did it once in a motor launch. All right? And if you want to get into the United States and you had something you're bringing in, you're not going to go across the border where they have nuclear detectors and stuff like that. There's thousands of miles of border. You could walk from Quebec into Maine or Vermont or New Hampshire. Does that go to the border? And, think of all the border regions you could do it. Or, like I say, I could go pick somebody. If I wanted to do things illegally, just like they used to bring booze across, they used to drive it across. When Lake St. Clair was frozen, they would drive booze from Canada during Prohibition. Same thing. If I wanted to bring in a terrorist, all I'd have to do is get a sailboat or get a, you know, any kind of boat and go, get it, just make any number of spots and you can pick them up. They're not going to drive in with some, load of whatever. All right, let's take our final calls. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
This is James from Westland.
Hi, James.
Now, earlier you asked if there's any solution to the immigration problem.
Yeah.
And I think I might have something, but it's kind of complex because the problem of immigration is complex.
Sure.
First off, you need to make things better where they're coming from. Okay, because they're leaving because it sucks there, right?
Yeah, and it's getting worse. Right.
Right. So we have to, if we want to stop them coming here, they need to have a better living condition there.
Sure. But part of how do you do that? I mean, things are worsening there.
We have to penalize big business for outsourcing jobs to Mexico, to China, to wherever, for pennies on the dollar.
Uh-huh.
If they're going to outsource there, outsource it at the same prices that they're doing it to us, you know?
Well, we could do that. We could make rules about exiting the U.S., exporting jobs, say that the wages that they pay in this country are ones that have to extend to other countries as well. You know, we're going to have to take this up another time because I'm about running out of it and I want to get these last two people. But either email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com or let's talk about it again next week. I'm sorry to cut you short, but I want to get these last callers in. All right, here's one of the last ones. Hi, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey. Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Oh, you know, it's been a while, and I've been listening for a long time, and I got a few things I'd like to say, and I'll get them off my chest, but what are we going to do with all these people who have all gone to Michigan to work, and we have this great man that they put in there, which is turned out to be the most terrible, but the blacks put him in there, and that's...
Who's that?
Their choice.
Wait. What are we talking about here? The blacks. What did the blacks...
Sorry. I wasn't even going in that route. But let's say we have all these people who moved to Michigan to work. Now we have people that are going to be out of jobs all around here, because everything is going to go to Japan, or it's going to go to Mexico.
No, not Japan, but yeah. But what? So what's the long and the short of it?
For cheaper wages.
Well, they don't get cheap labor in Japan, that's for sure.
Well, they're doing it. And then you get yourself over, you know, there's so many things to talk about.
Well, there is, and we're going to have to do it another time, unfortunately, because I'm running out of it. Here's our last caller. Hi, you're on Night Call. Welcome.
How you doing? This is Jacob from Dearborn.
Hi, Jacob.
Yeah, I was just calling to regarding a statement one of the other callers made earlier.
Yeah.
About raising like the minimum wage, because as everybody knows who lives in the metropolitan area here, they are raising the minimum wage in Michigan.
Oh, that's right. I should have mentioned that. What is it? What's it going up to?
It's going up to $6.95 in October, and then in 2008 in June, it's going up to $7.40.
That's right.
But the other caller earlier, he said something about if minimum wage was raised to as an incentive for, you know, more people to do the jobs that are so-called dirtier jobs that get lower wages, it's still going to cause more of an inflation in society, and it's going to cause a lot more of the deficit that we're already dealing with.
Well, you know what? That's the traditional argument against raising wages, and it's never proved to be the case. I mean, again, that's the business argument that that people in business will just raise wages to, when wages are raised, they'll raise prices to compensate for having to pay more for labor. But that again, if that's true, then that provides more argument for what I was saying, that this is a system based on blackmail. You can't even ask for more money, because even if you get more money, it's just a push for inflation, so we might as well just be happy with whatever we got. All right, have to talk about it another time, because I got to go. All right, thanks a lot. All right, stay tuned. We're going to do more on immigration. We have David Bacon, who's a labor reporter, and also Kelby Wilson, who's going to tell us a story based on her novel, where a woman gives birth to a hybrid. Boo. All right. Talk to you next week. Thanks for listening and calling.
This is WRIF.com.
Most revered and influential musicians of all time. A man the New York Times calls one of the most significant composers and individual saxophonists in jazz. Now, for one night only, Wayne Shorter is coming to Orchestra Hall. Don't miss the Wayne Shorter Quartet with jazz legend Wayne Shorter. From his early days as a member of the Miles Davis Quartet to his founding of the jazz fusion giants Weather Report, Wayne Shorter's influence on jazz has been immeasurable.
For one special night, Wayne Shorter brings his critically acclaimed quartet to Orchestra Hall for an evening of smooth and sophisticated jazz you'll not soon forget. Featuring timeless jazz standards like Speak No Evil, Footprints, and more. It's the Wayne Shorter Quartet, part of the LaSalle Bank Paradise Jazz Series, Thursday, April 6th in Orchestra Hall. Join us and experience the passion, the power, the performance of jazz at the max. Reserve your tickets today at 313-576-5111 or at DetroitSymphony.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Well, the big issue the last week or so has been immigration. Suddenly, it just popped out of nowhere. We were talking about the war, the economy, wiretapping, all of that. Suddenly, the papers, the televisions are just filled with these enormous demonstrations. I didn't even hear about the one that was going to happen in Detroit. Suddenly, I turn on the news and 14,000 people are in downtown Detroit. Of course, nothing like Los Angeles, where there was anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million people. Well, let's try to sort this out. Joining us to help us with the task is David Bacon. We've spoken to him before on the Peter Werby Show. He's a labor reporter and has been focusing on immigration issues, and he lives in Oakland. David Bacon, welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Yeah, this what do you make of this? That suddenly that this is barely on the radar, other than these vigilantes in Arizona, and it's all of a sudden quickly reached the level of national debate.
Well, I think that's a commentary actually on the media, is that, you know, the mainstream press has been really ignoring what's been taking place around immigration for some time, and it was only when it kind of came up above the ground in a way that couldn't be ignored any longer, like 1 million people in the streets in Los Angeles, that they began paying attention to it. But the truth of it is that, first of all, employers, big employers, some of the largest corporations in America, including Walmart, have been busy at work since 1998 trying to establish new guest worker or bracero programs. And they've been lobbying Congress all this time. This is something that the media didn't cover. This is an uncovered story. And they have been successful this year now in getting the president to endorse their program, in getting liberals in Congress like Kennedy to endorse it, and even some conservatives in Congress to endorse it. So that, unless something happens to stop this juggernaut, that is quite likely to become law in the United States again, and that would be like a return to what we had here in the country during the 1950s, when there were lots of workers who were brought in from Mexico under temporary contracts, paid very low wages, and had very few rights, much fewer rights than the people in the communities around them. So that's been happening all this time. And then we had some very, very conservative elements in Congress, James Sensenbrenner among others, who introduced a bill that would basically take a very, very punitive attitude towards immigrants. It would make being here without papers into a federal crime. It would build a wall along the border. It would make it much harder for people without papers to be able to work at all. And the combination of those two things were what brought people out into the streets of cities across the country. So you see people in these huge demonstrations carrying signs that say, I'm a worker, not a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
That's in reaction to Mr. Sensenbrenner's bill, the one that would criminalize people, and also calling for amnesty. And they use the word. People in these demonstrations use the word. You know, the Republicans have been trying to turn this into a bad word, as though amnesty were somehow some kind of really illegitimate, negative thing to do. But what people are really talking about is the fact that there are millions of people here, pretty much most people agree, over 10 million people here, who don't have any legal papers, and because of that, have a very difficult time becoming part of the communities that they live in. It's hard for people to get a driver's license and drive a car. It's illegal for people to work. It's easy for employers to put pressure on people to force them to agree to work overtime without overtime pay, for instance, and other kinds of abuses like that.
Which Walmart did.
That's right.
Incidentally,
and
yeah.
Meatpacking companies and janitorial companies. And, you know, we could, the list is pretty endless here. So people are tired of that. They, you know, basically when they say amnesty, they're saying, we want to be like everybody else. We want equal status here. You know, we work hard. We have kids. We go to school. We're members of the community. We're your neighbors next door. You like our food. You depend on our labor. Treat us equally. Treat us as though we are valuable people in the society here because we are. Don't treat us like, you know, we should be kind of some second-class people. This reminds me of the civil rights movement. This reminds me of African-American people demonstrating for voting rights or to integrate lunch counters in the South. It has that same kind of feeling to it because the demand is very similar, and that is equality, really.
Well, David Bacon, I have that same feeling, and one of the things that occurred to me without knowing the depth of emotions involved in this response to these anti-immigrant bills, that there's a lot more than just the practical concerns, that it is a thing about dignity or dignidad, I don't think my Spanish is too good, but that I was surprised in Detroit at the size of the demonstration, even though there were also people from the Arab community here. And people should realize that it's not just Hispanics in America, but it's people from Africa, it's people from Poland, from Ireland, from the Middle East. So we have this polyglot of people that are, in many ways, replicating what happened 80 and 100 and 120 years ago.
That's right. That's right. Although, you know, there are some important differences. One is the scale of it has really, you know, quite large now. I, you know, there have been other times in our history in the 1800s when immigrants made up a sizable percentage of the population, but the numbers weren't as large here. And I think this reflects something else that's happened, and that is, you know, the globalization of the world economy, or you could say the institution of a system of global inequality. So that you have countries, you know, when we passed, for instance, when the U.S. Congress passed NAFTA, this is one of the great ironies. Here you have Republicans in Congress who were big boosters of free trade and NAFTA passed the agreement. One of the results of that, just as one little example, was that it allowed big U.S. grain corporations, Cargill and Continental Grain Company, to dump cheap corn on the Mexican market, and at the same time, you had pressure from the U.S. saying that the Mexican government couldn't continue to subsidize corn prices for farmers. Now, what that really meant was that it became impossible to make a living as a small farmer growing corn in Mexico, and there are millions of people in Mexico for whom that is their way of making a living. So when NAFTA came along and did that in the interest of the high profitability of those grain companies, people were forced off the land, and in order to find a way of making a living, many of those people came to the United States. So you could go to Mr. Sensenbrenner or to some of these Republicans in Congress and even to Kennedy, who was also a vote in favor of NAFTA, and say, okay, you voted for this agreement. Why are you trying to run away from the consequences
sure.
of it? If you don't like the consequences of it, you should never have instituted this system to begin with.
And the vast majority of people, of course, do not come from Mexico to the United States, but rather leave the rural areas where they once were able to make a living, and they had these well-integrated traditional communities, and just wind up to be this urban mass, and who knows where Mexico City is at in terms of population,
right.
20 million, 21 million, 22 million. And in many ways, with all the immigrants that have come to the United States through the last, I don't know, probably since its origin, it probably is the most energetic people with the most ambition that they, I mean, that certainly, maybe we can talk a little about this as a way to, for you, David Bacon, to respond to this. Many ways the illegal immigrants are demonized. These are these terrible, horrible people that are entering our country illegally. They're taking American jobs. They're sending the money back to another country. They're the source of crime. And so, rather, no matter almost who is observing this, they're not the illegals are not thought of highly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What? How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, you know, we're talking about, as you say, a group of people that's 10 to 12 million people. So there's an enormous variety of people in that mix. But generally speaking, oftentimes the people who come to the United States are people who have a certain amount of education. Take a look at, for instance, people who come here from the Philippines. You have people who graduate from Philippine universities with who are, in fact, doctors and nurses there and go to work as orderlies here in U.S. hospitals because they can't get accreditation for the degrees that they got in the Philippines. And in a way, this is not a very positive thing for the Philippines because it's a kind of brain drain. But again, you know, this is a part of that global inequality. But when it becomes really hard for people to make a living, even with university degrees in their country of origin, people are going to go elsewhere looking for the welfare of their families. So mm-hmm. that's part of it. And you know, again, if we had a more just social order on a world level, then maybe people might still migrate from country to country. I don't think we'll ever go back to, you know, the Middle Ages where people just stayed in one place all their lives. But I think that people wouldn't do this as a result of such forcible pressures here, at least. So that's one aspect of it. But, you know, in terms of looking at immigrants as being the enemy, the stealers of jobs, I think that people certainly in Michigan, certainly in Detroit, might take a look at their school system, for instance. How, you know, look at the conditions of our high schools. And I've been in Detroit, I know. Our schools are in terrible shape. They need a lot of work. You know, we need to build new schools, renovate the old ones. We have classes in which a single teacher is responsible for 30, 35 students when we all know that if we have classes where there are only 20 students per teacher, students learn much more quickly, learn much better. There's a lot more individual attention. So it's not that we don't have work, necessary work, in our society that needs to be done. What it is that we have a government whose policy it is to foster the conditions which sort of line the pockets of private corporations and contractors and instead let the social needs that we have go unmet, in part because they want to turn around and say to those same wealthy folks, we're not going to raise your taxes. You're not going to have to pay for schools. You're not going to have to pay for building new schools or hiring teachers or any one of the 100 other things that we need to have done. So we're not suffering from a lack of work. We're suffering from misplaced social priorities.
Sure, and when you have hundreds of billions of dollars being spent on destroying a country and then rebuilding
that's right.
it, that's all. David Bacon's my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. David Bacon is a labor reporter. We're talking about immigration issues, and his website is dbacon.igc.org. I'll have a link to this on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, when you hear this show. Now, there's always been resistance to immigrants, even no matter what it says on the base of the Statue of Liberty. I mean, everybody, I think, knows that at one time there were signs that said "job open, no Irish need apply." Italians were called WOPs, without papers. Interestingly, to reflect what's going on now, the Jews of New York were characterized once by in the 1890s by the chief of police as being criminal by nature. And so, even though we have this romanticism about our relatives that now make up this country from Europe, those that are, they've always had a hard time integrating into American society, right?
That's right. You know, but we could sort of like flip that one around, too, by also saying that equally in American society, we've always had a movement of people for justice, for equality. Those Irish didn't like being discriminated against them. They built political machines in big urban areas that became, you know, quite powerful. We had a history of 400 years of struggle first against slavery and then against Jim Crow for equality for African Americans. So that's as much of the history of our world as is the fact that people coming here as immigrants had to enter U.S. society on the bottom, and in some cases, when we say that on the bottom, what we mean is that people were forcibly kidnapped and brought here in chains and forced to work as slaves, or Chinese people who were brought in as indentured labor and forced to work on the railroads. You know, that kind of very bitter inequality and bitter exploitation is part of our history, but so is the movement of people against it. And I think that that's one reason why it's important to remember that is because, for instance, right now, the most progressive immigration proposal in Congress, which is one that would grant amnesty to undocumented people and that would help to protect their rights and would also try and do things like foster a new job creation and job training program in communities with high unemployment so that people wouldn't be pitted against each other in job competition at the bottom of the workforce. This very far-sightful bill was introduced by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, an African-American woman from Houston, who herself says that what we have to have in this country is a new civil rights movement, and with the support of the Congressional Black Caucus. And I think it's because people can look across that racial divide and say, hey, I recognize what's going on with you. You know, you want equality just the way, you know, we do. And also see, you know, what the problems are that people confront. And I feel, even though there are these very, very negative proposals in Congress, I think it's things like that that make me more optimistic, that make me more hopeful that we can come out of this with something that's actually going to move people out of the shadows and move people towards equality and freedom in this country rather than treat people as though they're the enemy just simply because they need to work.
Well, let's go back a little, both to the status of people that have entered the country illegally and about whether or not jobs suffer for people that are here legally, both native-born and legal immigrants. There's usually 22,000 men, women, and children detained on any given day on immigration charges, and numerous people are immediately sent back. So there is this enforcement process going on. There one thing that's called for is enforcing the laws. And some of the people in this debate, not necessarily liberal or conservative, say, look, you have this great number of people that have violated the laws of the United States. They're essentially queue jumping. They're demanding to jump ahead of what the immigration laws provide for how people would orderly be admitted to this country, and to submit to mass illegal immigration and mass demonstrations demanding that be approved doesn't do well for the rule of law nor for the economy.
Well, that's a complicated problem.
It is.
First of all, we need to face the reality that we have closed the door effectively to people being able to come here legally. Right now, if you walk into the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City and you say, my name is John Smith, and I want to go to the United States, you know, please give me a visa, the line stretches all the way back to people who made their first application in 1972.
Huh.
That is not a... especially when at the same time the U.S. is doing things in Mexico to increase the pressure on people to leave, that is basically forcing people to come here without the visa, because you're saying we're not going to give you a visa and we are still going to do things in your country that is going to make it really impossible for your family to survive. So we are in some ways the creators of this situation here. And the way out of the situation is, on the one hand, to stop, creating favorable economic conditions for, you know, large corporations and miserable ones for working people, and at the same time, to allow people to come legally rather than forcing them to come illegally.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a situation where, on one hand, the Republicans say how wonderful the economy is and how low unemployment is. So you would think, I mean, it would be one thing if Native American people, Native-born Americans, would have had like 8 or 9% unemployment. So there apparently is room for all these the illegals to do we should say the so-called illegals. I know one of the slogans is no one is illegal because these are human beings. Yet even some liberal commentators like Paul Krugman said there is a downward pressure on wages, and it's one of the reasons that the Walmarts of the world have no problem with this, and big construction firms, and people see that the protected American wage is soon going to be globalized, and rather than having a structure where everyone is all boats are floated upwards or whatever the hell it is, this is going to be part one little segment of driving all wages down.
Well, you know, people don't cross that border with a sticker on their forehead saying, "Pay me $5 an hour." The decision on what to pay for jobs in the United States is made by employers in the United States. So if you have meatpacking plants, I was just in Tar Heel, North Carolina for a week talking to workers at the big Smithfield plant, the largest pork processing plant in the world. And this company is a violently, I use that word literally, a violently anti-union company in which people who have been in favor of the union there have been beaten up or dragged out of that plant in handcuffs, fired, just subjected to extreme forms of anti-union hostility. Those lines run so fast in that plant that that plant produces injured workers, permanently disabled workers, almost as fast as it produces pork. So this company, one of the ways in which they can continue to function is by trying to force that wage down as much as possible. And they do that by, obviously opposing people when they try and organize unions, and also to use every means that they can to put pressure on workers. And so, yes, they do hire workers who are vulnerable people and say, hey, you know, if you stick your head up above the ground here, you're going to get fired. And, we might know, the foreman might know what your legal status is, and, you could get in trouble because of that, too. So you better just sort of, like, hunker down and, mm-hmm. Do what we tell you to. That's not a decision that's made by those workers.
Well, I think also
that's a decision that's made by that employer.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that how all this is acted to the benefit of the employers, but how the old way of employment also had some problems. The meatpackers were highly unionized in Nebraska mm-hmm. and Chicago and North Carolina. It was almost exclusively a white male purview. And the unions had a good wage. Well, those unions have virtually all gone away, and now they're all immigrants. Sometimes, like in Nebraska, there's Somalis, and so this is a way in which the wages have been driven down. And it's a double-edged sword. It's an argument for quote not letting people in because they will work for lower wages. But ultimately, it's what you said, David Bacon. You have this artificial line drawn across this piece of land. Auto workers on one side in here in Detroit make $24 an hour, and you go across the other side, they're making $2.40 an hour. So the pressure, where's the pressure to go? I mean, that only makes common sense. Don't these guys all live and die by supply and demand?
Well, when you think back about what happened to meatpacking workers here in the United States, one of the biggest union struggles we ever had in this country was in the back of the yards in Chicago in 1919, and the big fights that followed it that eventually led to the organization of the United Packing House Workers, which was the union for meatpacking workers in this country. And it was a union in which there were a lot of white workers, but there were also black workers. In fact, that union was one of the most important unions in terms of breaking down the color line, not just inside the plant, but also took the lead in cities like Omaha in going and picketing restaurants and bars.
I stand corrected then. Thank you for that. I appreciate
that. So that was the vehicle for equality in that era. And I think that it still is. You know, the workers who are coming into the Smithfield plant, you know, they have undergone some really, I would say, valiant struggles to try and organize themselves in the face of this kind of hostility. I was in Omaha a couple of years ago and saw the big ConAgra meatpacking, the beef plant in Omaha, get organized when those immigrant workers, you know, not only stuck their heads up above the ground, but, you know, did all of the different things that are necessary for workers to be able to organize and to confront the company there. So I don't think that these folks here who are coming here are passive people. In fact, in some ways, I think that this is a real boon to unions and a real boon to other workers, because people are coming here with different ideas about how to organize themselves that are sometimes more successful than what we've been trying in unions in the United States for the last 30 or 40 years. You know, we got used to this idea, for instance, that during a strike in the U.S. that employers were free to bring in strike breakers and that there was, you know, pretty much nothing we could do about that, even if we didn't like the idea. And so, you know, you had our picket lines. You'd see people kind of like more or less just sort of standing there, sitting there with their picket signs, watching the, you know, strike breakers go through. Well, you know, if you have a strike of Mexican workers in a food processing plant in Detroit, you're not going to see picket lines that look like that. Believe me, people are going to fight really hard to keep their jobs and to win those, you know, struggles in a way that I think we haven't seen for quite a long time. So
we're out of time, unfortunately. There's a lot here, and I hope you listeners have seen that. If you're just listening like to Lou Dobbs or something like that, there's a lot more opinion on all of this. Please try to get it. This is an incredibly important issue that ultimately will affect all of the wage structures of, or at least many people in this country. David Bacon is a labor reporter. You can go to dbacon.igc.org. David, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
It was a pleasure, Peter.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Boy, we're going to have fun and learn something with this session of the Peter Werby Show. Joining me from the Siskiyou Mountains of Oregon is writer, editor, and engineer Kelpie Wilson. Kelpie Wilson is an environmental activist. That's where I first met her years ago, and her articles have appeared in Wild Earth, The Progressive, and the Earth First Journal. She's currently an editor and writer for the very important truthout.org. Hopefully you know that already. If you don't, check it out, or you can go to my site, PeterWerby.com, and see it as well. It's an online news service, and it's got a worldwide audience. And Kelpie Wilson, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hello, Peter.
My old pal.
Yeah.
You live in a solar-powered cabin?
Yeah, I do.
That's very cool.
Solar and small hydro.
Yeah, and you mean water power?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a little perennial stream here on the property that runs a little water wheel.
Now, your book, which one would think, since I introduced you as an environmental activist, would be nonfiction. However, it is a book of fiction. It's called Primal Tears. It is published by Frog Limited. I like that. And it's the strangest story. Bring us into it. Bring us into Primal Tears, Kelpie Wilson. What is the novel about? I think that's the best way to set the conversation.
All right. Well, let me just start first by saying why I wrote the novel.
Sure.
And it stems from my experience as an environmental activist and some of the frustration that I experienced over the years, primarily of people expressing that they are separate from nature. And when you become versed in ecology and the way the physical world works on our planet, you realize that we're not separate. Human beings are animals. We depend on all the other creatures around us for our sustenance. And so the separation idea is artificial. It's a philosophical, sometimes a religious precept that just isn't right. And so I kept running up against this attitude in my work and, you know, being frustrated by it. And so I started trying to imagine how this attitude could be broken down and changed. And in that imagining, I imagined a story, and the story was Primal Tears.
And an incredible story, and talk about the integration of humans with nature. Go right ahead, Kelpie Wilson.
All right. Well, the premise is, and this comes from a lot of reading that I did about human evolution and other creatures, that a lot of people have heard about this, that recent genetic discoveries have found that human beings and chimpanzees are very close genetically, something like 98.6%, 99% genetic identity between our two species. And, you know, reading further about, for instance, hybrids like a mule is a hybrid between a donkey and a horse. A donkey and a horse are no closer genetically than a human and a chimpanzee. So it seemed possible that a human and a chimpanzee could mate.
Mm-hmm. Where are we going here?
So my story, the human and the chimpanzee do not actually mate,
yeah.
But rather there is a laboratory accident and a hybrid human chimpanzee is produced. And so the story follows this character. She's a young female named Sage. And
this is the offspring. Sage is the offspring.
This is the offspring, yeah. Yes. And so the story begins in a place very much like my home here in southern Oregon in the Siskiyou Mountains. And a young couple, Sarah, the mother, and Kevin, the father, although he's not actually the biological father, but he's Sarah's husband. And Sarah is actually fired from her job as a school teacher because she's been teaching evolution.
Uh-oh.
And she's living in a conservative area, and the principal is a conservative Christian who believes in creation science, doesn't like this young woman teaching evolution in his school, and fires her. So she's at loose ends and not knowing what to do without a job and really wants to have a baby. But her husband is completely against having children. And he's an environmentalist, and he sees the problem of human overpopulation, and so he just doesn't want to bring another human into the world. They decide to adopt, but In the meantime, Sarah hears about a program at a lab where human women are being asked to actually act as surrogate mothers for endangered bonobo chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you should, at this point, tell us, because the bonobos figure mightily in your book, Kelpie Wilson, Primal Tears, about the bonobos. They've become kind of to the fore recently, but still, I don't think everybody can differentiate between them, you know, your run-of-the-mill chimp, if you will, and our cousins, the bonobos.
Yes, the bonobos are fascinating. They're kind of new to science, so a lot of it has been written about them in recent years because their behavior is a little different from a regular or common chimp. They live in larger social groups. Their social structure is a little more female-oriented mm-hmm. than male-dominated, and they're really notable for their extreme sexual activity. They have a lot of sex all the time, and it's really interesting because one of the consequences of that is that they are very peaceful. And in fact, they have sex not to have a lot of babies, but they do it to cement their social bonds with each other, and it leads to a very peaceful society. They're one of the few other species in the world, like humans, that seems to use sex not primarily for reproduction, but for social bonding.
Mm-hmm. And pleasure, I suppose.
And pleasure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's partly their popularity in the popular imagination lately, that here in nature, because what, you have these orangutan colonies where these the males are killing each other and ganging up on one another, and suddenly here the peaceful bonobos that would are saying, you know, make love, not war.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly the distinction. And so a lot of people are paying attention because here we live in a world that's just consumed with conflict, and people are looking very, almost desperately for alternatives. And I, you know, when you look throughout history and through anthropological studies, you see that there's tremendous plasticity in human behavior, and we can choose to behave differently. But we need to set things up so that our needs are met.
Mm-hmm. Kelpie Wilson, on the back of your book, Primal Tears, to introduce the book, it says, a cross between a human and a bonobo. Carl Sagan and others have speculated, is that possible? Is Sagan himself was wondering this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In one of his books, he has a little passage where he speculates about the possibility of it, and he says, well, it's certainly possible. We don't know of any instance where it's actually happened, but it's certainly possible.
Now, you write quite a bit. You've written, as we said, numerous newspaper articles, and now quite frequently for truthout.org. This is your first novel, though, correct?
Yes, it is.
So when, I mean, obviously there's nothing autobiographical about the merging of two species in this one woman and the offspring and all the intrigue and excitement and that flows from it in your book, Primal Tears. But I always wonder, in a first novel, how much of it is autobiographical, which could go from zero, we have to get the premise out of there, to 0 to 90%.
I mean, well, you're right. I don't have a half bonobo baby around the house.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
Although I have to admit, it was kind of a fantasy.
Yeah.
And some of the motivation for the book came from my own personal decisions about whether or not to have children, and feeling that, you know, like Kevin, my character Kevin, I didn't really want to bring a child into an overcrowded world, but on the other hand, I love animals, and the idea of having an animal baby is appealing in mm-hmm. a fantastical kind of sense. So, but there, a lot of the book is autobiographical in the sense of the settings. It's set here in Southern Oregon. It's beautiful, wild, mountainous country here. Some of the last big tracts of ancient forests that are left in the country are here. A lot of it, there are a lot of scenes that take place in the wilderness, and some of them I actually wrote when I was in the wilderness backpacking. So it really reflects my love for the place here. And some of the characters in the book are, you know, represent some of my wacky friends out here.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Well, it always strikes me, as you know, I write quite a bit as well. And yet, if someone told me to write a novel, I don't even think I could write a short story, to tell you the truth. I suppose if someone said you had to, or they offered me a lot of money, I'd give it a whirl. But I just don't feel it in me. I mean, so I always assumed that these were sort of bursting forth. Although Edison, what did Edison say? That inventions are 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. I mean, just.
Oh yeah, there's quite a bit of work involved, no doubt. Lots of revisions, and yes, Peter, I never thought I would write fiction either. I'm an essayist like you, you know, and well, I write news analysis for Truth Out. But I just sat down one day and just this idea was just grabbing me, and I knew there was no way. It was a fantasy. There's no way to turn it into an essay.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wrote the first chapter, and I was amazed at how easily it came out. And then after that, I spent some time studying the craft of fiction writing, which is a definite craft that you can learn. You aren't necessarily just born with the ability. And it became my therapy, actually, over several years while I was working an intense job as a environmental advocate. I'd come home at night and enter this fantasy world and see where the story went next.
Is there in your writer's heart a second novel, a third novel, a fourth novel? So, we know some of these people are writers. They kick out 16 or 20 of them during their lifetime. Here, I'm saying I can't even imagine a short story. So this is a question more out of my own curiosity. Is there a lot more aborning there?
There could be. You know, I have a couple outlines for other novels. I'd love to write more fiction. It's really a lot of fun. It's a matter of finding the time.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Kelpie Wilson. She's authored the novel Primal Tears, and the setting of it is a hybrid comes out of a young woman who has volunteered to be a surrogate mother for an endangered species of chimpanzee, the bonobos, and everything that happens within that. Now, I have with me here a couple of very, very good reviews of it. Do the people that in your community out in southern Oregon, in the mountains there, are they aware of this book? And how did it play in the Siskiyou Mountains?
Well, lots of people here locally have read it. I have a pretty wide circle of friends and acquaintances, and they were all interested to know that their friend had written a novel. And, of course, everybody wanted to know if they were in it or not. They all bought the book and read it.
But no one was offended.
No,
that's
no,
good.
And I was actually surprised at that.
Well, I was thinking of an author we both know, the late Freddie Perlman. He wrote one novel of all his books of essays, and people were just outraged at the way he characterized them. Many, I don't blame him. Well, that's good. That would give me that encourages me all the more. Primal Tears is the book. It's published by Frog Limited, although you can go to NorthAtlanticBooks.com. And Kelpie Wilson, I wonder if you could just grab your book, Primal Tears, and maybe read us a passage or two.
Sure, I'd love to. Okay, so let me give you a quick synopsis first. So Sarah has been fired by a conservative principal for teaching evolution, and she's decided, now that she's footloose and fancy-free, that she's going to volunteer for this program to help incubate endangered bonobo chimpanzee using her womb, the idea is that these bonobos are endangered. There's very few of them. They want to increase the captive breeding population. She volunteers just to incubate and carry a bonobo embryo to term, but a laboratory accident lets some bonobo sperm get in there with the implanted embryo, and she gets pregnant and has a hybrid human chimpanzee. So she's raising this child in the Oregon, you know, in a remote area in the Oregon mountains. But at a certain point, there are some enemies who find out about this, and they don't like it, and they are coming after the family to take Sage, the daughter, away from the family. And so they are fleeing through the wilderness. So they're in the wilderness fleeing, and a drop of sweat ran into Sarah's eye and stung. She wiped it away and looked up from the ground. Kevin's blue backpack bobbed up and down above the oak brush ahead. What a pillar of strength he was. Following him was Sage, steadfastly covering the rocky ground. Sage's way of walking was to lift each knee high, angled outward from her center, and carefully place each foot before lifting the other knee. She moved in a curious sort of bent-kneed waddle, yet she was fast. Sage walked funny and talked funny, her funny little hybrid, her Jenny Mule. Sarah strained and her thighs ached as she lifted her legs over one more boulder. This couldn't be happening. These militias and government men weren't really going to drive them from their home because of Sage. Who could be threatened by Sage? She was so harmless, so innocent. Hickston's face flashed in front of her. She remembered his teeth, yellowed incisors clapped together as he hissed Satan at her. Satan was a hybrid, part goat, part man, part scaly beast. That's what they were all afraid of. Not Sage in particular, but the hybrid zone, where borders were mushy and permeable. So that's Sarah with the family fleeing in the wilderness, and then at a little later point in time, Sage gets separated from the family, and she ends up spending time alone in the wilderness, kind of reconnecting with her, the animal side of her nature.
And Hickson is the principal that has fired Sarah, that kind of begins it all. Yeah, all
that's
right.
Correct.
Tell
mm-hmm.
me, Wilson, go ahead, more reading from Primal Tears, please.
Okay, so Sage actually has spent some time living with some bears in the wilderness, and she's discovering what it's like to also be an animal as well as a human. No longer wallowing in bear love, Sage opened herself to all the beings of the mountains. She wanted to learn how to speak with the coyote and the hummingbird, even the plants and the trees. And she approached everything she encountered with love and a willingness to absorb its essence. Her own being seemed to melt away in the presence of a tiny tree frog, or even a drop of dew hanging on a rush, sparkling in the early morning sun. So that's Sage experiencing the wilderness by herself.
Okay. And did you have one more? Or?
Yeah, just to give you a sense of how the novel flows and what some of the themes are. So then later on in the book, Sage and her family are reunited. And so this next passage is Sarah's perception of Sage now, that she's been separated and reunited, and Sage is a little older, a little more grown up. So Sarah and Kevin had spent the previous weekend at the camp, and she had begun to struggle with the profound changes in her daughter. Sage was no longer a child. Gone was the appealing baby fat that had made her little ape so human to her. Her face was bonier now, more defined. She knew it was partly the shock of seeing a dead child return to life as a randy teenager with no intervening steps, but there was more. You know, since Sage has been away, she has become both more and less human to me, Sarah said. How do you mean, Kevin said. Well, physically, she hasn't just grown up. She's also gotten a lot stronger and, oh, I don't know, wilder looking. Her face, her brow ridge is heavier. But then her busts and her hips have filled out, so her figure looks more Homo sapiens. But it's not just her face. It's also in the way she moves, so quickly sometimes, more like a wild animal. Sage had become a woman. She had also become an ape.
Hmm. From Primal Tears by my guest, Kelpie Wilson, you're listening to The Peter Werby Show. In this novel, Primal Tears, it's pretty clear that the intolerant right-wing Christian conservatives are the bad guys. Yet, on the other hand, I wonder about the Kelpie Wilson I know that has been critical of the hubris of science. In other words, this child is a product of science. In fact, many people would say, before they realize that the hybrid child has a character worth admiring, this is science gone amok. This is Frankenstein science.
Oh, I think that's true. You know, it's even though this is not a genetic engineering case, it's a case of a natural hybrid, it's really unnatural. You know, in nature, you would not find a mating between two such species. So, yes, you're correct. It is unnatural. It is shocking. I'm certainly not advocating that we produce human animal hybrids.
No, I meant how wrong or, quote, bad, how bad are the bad guys really when they're critical of this process that probably at least at some level you'd be critical as well?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's what they're critical of, though, is not so much the process as it's really their fear, I guess, that I'm trying to get into. Their fear of what is non-human and their fear of the connection. And so by creating the hybrid, it's a physical manifestation of the deep connectedness that we do have with nature. And so it's an very extreme example.
Sure.
An unnatural one. But it's the fear of that connectedness that I'm trying to illustrate that the bad guys are exhibiting, and that I'm trying to say we need to not be afraid of that connection.
I think, too, Kelby Wilson, if this had been written 50 or 60 years ago, it would also serve as a parable about tolerance, that here's someone that's different. And, let's just talk a little, because I see by the clock we're starting to run out of time, is that just as an environmental activist and on one hand, what your story brings to us, but also it's almost in the back of all the big political debates that we're having, the environment is more and more threatened. I remember that your area of southern Oregon in the Siskiyou Mountains was once threatened with the logging. Is it still under the gun?
Oh, absolutely. In some ways, even more so than ever. The Gail Norton's Interior Department, the Interior Department under George Bush, has decided to open up all of the old growth forests left that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management to logging. And so we're facing big logging plans here in Southern Oregon and all across the western states. Then you've got the sell-off of public lands that the Bush administration is promoting quite heavily. The threats are imminent and larger than ever.
Well, in the 1980s and into the 1990s, there was great resistance to the logging of these of our natural heritage, of the planet's natural heritage, not ours, of the planet's natural heritage. Is there still resistance to this? Is it still happening?
Yes, there is.
Yeah. What's it look like today? Maybe then there were big, like, tree sit-ins. People were,
tree sits.
Tree sits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. There were some tree sits here in my area last summer, some road blockades. It's tough, though, because those things don't really stop much. What seems to stop the development is lots of letter writing, lots of political action. The tree sits, the blockades get attention. They get less attention now. That's why you're not hearing about them. People, they've seen it before.
That's interesting because the argument was made probably at the time that direct action was necessary because political activity and letter writing campaigns didn't go anywhere. So we've kind of gone... Oh, the clock's gone around another 12 hours or something.
Well, how do you make a difference politically? What are the levers for political action? I think that often it's a combination of things. You know, the demonstration may get the attention, but the hard work of commenting and letter writing and so forth actually moves the politicians. Although at this point, with the Bush administration, nothing seems to work, frankly.
Yeah. Well, you can. The other thing is, you can put a million people in the street in Los Angeles or Paris or New York City, and it's pretty hard to get people out to the Siskiyou Mountains to actually create enough of a quantity of people to affect change. I think
that's true, and the issues have matured. If things had gone along with the Clinton administration, and if we had had Al Gore in office rather than Bush, we would have been in a much better position because we actually accomplished a lot throughout the 90s. by interjecting science into the debate, increasing the influence of biologists in the managing agencies. We were starting to see some really good cooperation between a lot of different parties in this area, between even the timber industry and environmentalists. And the Bush policies have just destroyed all of that, and it's really sad.
Mm-hmm. Kelby Wilson, I want to thank you for being on the Peter Werby Show. Again, the book is Primal Tears, an incredible first novel about a hybrid bonobo and human and everything that that happens once she hits the human world. Kelby Wilson, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
This is Gene Simmons of KISS.
Hey everyone, this is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters. And you're listening to 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Caught up in the chains again.
101 WRIF Detroit, everything that rocks with the KID.
Cowboy. Cowboy.
Well, I'm packing up my game and I'ma head out west, where real women come equipped with scripts and fake breasts. Find a nest in the hills, chill like Flint, buy an old drop top, find a spot to.